Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and theater lovers of all ages. Welcome to the third annual WGBB Tony Award Special, only on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. I'm Dave Lefkowitz, the host of Dave's Gone By, which airs Sunday nights on WGBB, and I'm here because I love the theater, and I want to share 3 hours of theater fun with you. And I'm going to be joined by a bunch of wonderful special guests, including my two co-hosts, Jeffrey Goodman, who is a co-host on Manhattan Cable Television's Two on the Isle program, and Simon Saltzman, who is the president of the Outer Critics Circle. Also joining us, either by phone or pre-recorded or perhaps even live, some special guest critics, including Ellis Nasur, Richmond Shepherd, Rosalind Friedman, Iris Dorbian, Jeannie Lieberman, Glenn Loney, Michael Portantier, and Charlie Gross. And we'll be talking to Tony-nominated choreographer Bill T. Jones, who was nominated for Spring Awakening. So ladies and gentlemen, sit back, we're going to have a wonderful conversation, we're going to talk about all the nominees in the different categories, we're going to talk about the theater season in general, Broadway, and even a little bit of off-Broadway, and of course, we're going to be playing show tunes, like this track here from Curtains. So, stay with us until 10 o'clock tonight, it's the WGBB Tony Awards Special. Thank you so much for being with us. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome on this Monday evening, June 4th, to the WGBB Tony Awards Special, our third annual special. Three makes it a routine, a ritual now.
David, that was fantastic.
Thank you so much. That voice belongs to the one and only Jeffrey Goodman. I'm using your full Jeffrey name.
Ooh.
Rather than Jeff, because this is a special occasion.
Well, that's my Price is Right name.
That's right. Jeff, who has been seen briefly on the Price is Right, but also people would know him for appearing weekly on the Manhattan Cable Television program Two on the Isle with guest, well, his co-critic, Charles Gross, and Charles will be calling in a while to talk about some of the Tony categories. Also joining me as co-host for this three-hour evening is the one and only Simon Saltzman. Simon is the president of the Outer Critics Circle, which is a bit... That wasn't Simon, that was Jeffrey there.
Wait, as Menashe Skolnick used to say, I'm not the manager, I'm the manager. I'm not the president, I'm the president.
You're running things gently, in a nice way. Tell us just a little bit about the OCC.
The OCC, or otherwise known as the Outer Critics Circle, is comprised of reviewers, critics, and members of the profession that cover the New York theater, both Broadway and off-Broadway, and for 57 years.
So which is it older than the Tonys, or a little younger, or...?
We began the season of 1949-50, so it's a little bit younger. I think the Tonys began in 47.
Right. Something right. Like that. Yeah, that's right.
But I heard Antoinette Perry actually moved to the Outer Critics Circle and started that.
That's right. With Lucille Lortel. They worked on it together.
That's right.
So, and...
By the way, the OCC is also a place in California.
What is that?
That's the OC. You know, they have that TV show. It's Orange County. Okay. It's Orange County County.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that bit of trivia, Jeff. But
some people actually think that the Outer Critics are the critics that aren't allowed in the theater. They have to hear the show from Schubert Alley or some such.
Well, that's when they have the rings in the theater, like in the Met and stuff like that. You get the outer ring.
There you go. Exactly. There you go. And you should also make clear that one of the things about the OCC or the Outer Critics Circle is that you cover both Broadway and off-Broadway, as opposed to the Tonys.
And off-Broadway.
Not as much as that other group, the Drama Desk.
The DD, as I like to call them.
The ODD, right?
No, that's the Outer Drama Desk. That would just be me. That's what they do to me in the Drama Desk. They place my desk outside the room.
Oh, now.
ODD.
Anyway,
we're the first major awards to be presented. The first awards to be given and nominated.
In a given season. You're trying to get the jump on everybody else.
We do get the jump on everybody else. And we set the tone for the whole season. Yeah.
Ooh. So, welcome to Saw the Tone Setter.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's set the tone. Let me just remind everybody of what's going to be happening.
What's happening, Dave?
Two different Tony nominees that we will be talking to, including Bill T. Jones, the choreographer of Spring Awakening, and also the lovely actress Rebecca Luker, who is now in Mary Poppins.
Dave, that's one more than we had last year.
Yeah, we're
that
doubling
means
everything.
Next year we're going to have either three or four if we double.
We'll see. Let's see how this one goes. Let's get through the next 3 hours.
It's going to be fantastic.
I think so.
So don't touch that dial.
Stay here till 10 o'clock, because also we've got a whole bunch of theater critics, and each of them is going to be taking on one or two categories, explaining who's in the categories, who they think will win, and who they think should win. Among them, folks like Ellis Nasur, who's a published author, Michael Portantier, he's the senior editor of Theater Mania, Rosalind Friedman, a Connecticut critic, Iris Dorbian, the editor-in-chief of Stage Directions magazine, and even the one and only Michael Riegel from the New York Post is going to be chiming in the WGBB Tony Awards special.
David?
Mm-hmm?
Then what do we do? What does Saul and I do?
Oh, you're just sort of here for moral support.
Simon. Okay. I said Simon. I said, what does Simon and I do?
Sorry.
Yeah. So what you do is you're just with this food here, you can eat.
Welcome to the Tony Ward restaurant.
You can give me periodic massages if I start to tire. You're my backbone.
Then the food we ate on the floor in your room.
I was thinking about the pastrami on the way up that got me here on time.
Actually, what I'm really thinking about is our first guest, aside from you, that would be Richmond Shepherd. He's the owner of the Richmond Shepherd Theater, among the many other millions of things that this man has done in his career. And he's going to be talking about two categories, best direction of a play, best direction of a musical. Here is Richmond Shepherd. Our next guest on this Tony Award special show on WGBB. Now, we've only got 10 minutes with him, and I could take that time just to list and enumerate all the amazing things he has done in his career. He's owned theaters in California. He's performed as an actor, as a mime. He's directed. He's produced. He's been on the radio. He's been a theater critic. He's Richmond Shepherd, and right now he even owns a theater off Broadway in New York. He's even working on a play that he's directed. What is it, No Exit? You're doing?
We're doing No Exit. Opens June 12th through 24th.
At the Richmond Shepherd Theater on
309 East 26th.
So everybody go see that. But right now we've got Richmond right here to talk about two categories in this year's Tony Awards. First one is Best Direction of a Play. The nominees are Michael Grandage for Frost Nixon, David Grinley, Journey's End, Jack O'Brien, The Coast of Utopia, and Melly Still for the recently departed Coram Boy. Richmond, go. What are your thoughts?
You know, the guy deserves an awful lot of credit for The Coast of Utopia. He made a dull show, a long, boring, rhetoric-filled show, into an exciting production. And I bet he wins the award because the visuals he put in, it became an exciting production experience. Bob Crowley, the greatest designer in the world, did it. So I gotta give it to him.
And I think he's the odds-on favorite to win.
Now, Coram Boy was really well directed, really well. The British know how to put on a show. Unfortunately, the play was like bad Dickens. And the Frost Nixon. I would say that Frank Langella's performance is one of the greatest I've ever seen in my entire life. It was amazing. How much the director brought to that, I don't know. The other characters were the other characters, and Vangelis was head and shoulders above everybody except the guy who played Frost, who was also very good. And what was the next one?
And Journey's End, David Green.
Journey's End, I would nix that director.
Oh.
The acting was good, the set was terrific, the play was interesting, and for some strange reason, to keep the atmosphere of the trenches in World War I so dimly lighted that everybody is straining to see, so you're not only straining to see, to hear, you're straining to see. He lost me, even though it was well staged, and the acting was, you know, really well directed.
Now let's jump to the musicals of the season. The ones that are nominated for Tony Awards include Company, directed by John Doyle, Curtains, staged by Scott Ellis, Grey Gardens, helmed by Michael Greif, and Spring Awakening, which was awakened by Michael Mayer. Your thoughts?
I would put Spring Awakening at the bottom of my list.
Aha!
I thought it was a pretty good show, especially for young people. The simulated sex on the stage is going to get them all excited. It didn't get me excited.
Oh, okay.
I didn't love the show. I think Doyle's going to win for Company. I thought his innovation is brilliant. I thought his Sweeney Todd last year was absolutely brilliant. Who else did you have?
Let's see. There was Scott Ellis for Curtains.
Curtains was terrific. That was a lot of fun. It deserved a nomination. It definitely did. I enjoyed that one. And you know, he would be high up in my list. Go ahead. What else?
And Michael Greif for Grey Gardens.
I don't know how much of it was Michael or how much of it was Christine. But once again, a great performance. Her performance, to me, ranks up with the greatest ones I've ever seen, which includes Paul Robeson as Othello, Laurence Olivier with Vivian Leigh in Caesar and Cleopatra, and John Malkovich in Burn This. Those Christine's performance is up there with them in my book. So,
it was
more. You know who I would vote for? Oh, I know. I'm sorry, I didn't get nominated.
Who?
Pirate Queen.
Now I have to tell you, I'm going to be appearing on the public television show Theater Talk with Michael Regal and Susan Haskins, and they grabbed a bunch of us critics and they put us all one after the other in the chair to ask us to talk about one or two different categories. And the big joke of the night for Michael is he had all of us, whether we agreed with it or not, he put us in the chair and said, okay, what was the worst show of the 2006-2007 season? And he forced us, at pain of, I guess, editing, to all say The Pirate Queen. Even though some of us, you know, were okay with it, some of us didn't hate it, but you will literally see this montage of all these critics, famous and not, going, Pirate Queen, Pirate Queen.
Well,
but you liked it.
If you say in show business, and I won't use the profanity on the air, if he can't take a joke, I love the Irish step dancing. I like the swag. I went to see that show with a woman, Barbara Horn, who teaches in the theater department at St. John's with me.
Mm-hmm.
She's the author of 8 books on theater. The last one was on Edward Albee. And she said to me at the end of the show, she smiled and she said, not a dull moment.
Hmm.
How many shows can say that? Two tourists that I know, separate people, came into town within the last 2.5 weeks. Among the 4 or 5 shows each one saw, a bunch of musicals, both of them said they liked The Pirate Queen the best. So I'm not alone.
So, yeah, and it certainly seems to be reaching its target audience.
It's a lot of fun.
Okay.
Fun is okay in theater.
And the director, you feel, is very much responsible for that.
Yes, absolutely. And I would have... No, I wouldn't say that's not the winner, but I certainly would have given it a nomination.
What was your favorite show of the season on or off Broadway?
One of my most favorite off Broadway was Exits and Entrances.
The Ethel Fugard drama.
Moreland Higgins did a performance that stands out head and shoulders above most of what was done on or off Broadway this year. And at the end of the play, he's playing this ham actor.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the play, he does Hamlet's soliloquy, To Be or Not to Be. I have never seen it done better. I've seen Richard Burton do it on the stage. I've seen Olivier, saw Maurice Evans. I've seen everybody. I have never seen it done better. It was up there with the best in the world.
Wow.
Is Hamlet's soliloquy. Moreland Higgins is, I would have nominated him for everything.
Wow. And I have to ask, because we have a little bit of time, and we're with Richmond Shepherd here. Do you remember the worst thing you saw all season, or did you just block that out?
I blanked it with several of them that, you know, was so painful that I left it intermission. I don't want to encourage them. But can I get a quick plug in?
Go ahead.
Nick Wilson and I did a new translation of No Exit by Sartre, and that's the first 2/3 of the evening at my theater starting on June 12th. And then Michaela Leon, the German cabaret singer, I had her put together a cabaret show for half an hour as a dessert of Juliet Greco songs. She was a contemporary of Sartre and a friend of his. So call me and call the theater and come and see it. It's $25, gets you admission and a drink.
And a drink, hey! Why not? Well, I lift my glass and toast
and
to you.
And it's S-H-E-P-A-R-D, Richmond, capital of Virginia, Shepherd guards the sheep. So you can...
Richmond Shepherd, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much, Richmond. Best of luck on that show.
I appreciate being on your show.
Thanks, man.
Bye.
Richmond Shepherd, ladies and gentlemen, on the WGBB Tony Award special. Jeff, yes?
We always have to thank the capital of Virginia for watching our sheep, don't we?
Oh, I totally agree. I totally. I'm here with Jeff Goodman. I'm here with Simon Saltzman on this lovely, lovely evening. It's just a few days before the Tony Awards that actually happen on Sunday night, June 10th. But we're here talking about all the different nominees, all the different categories. And Jeff and Simon and I are now going to take up the
grueling task of deciding which of the two special theatrical events.
There are only two all season.
If you want to consider them special at all.
Ooh.
Okay, well, they are Jay Johnson, The Two and Only. That's the one where he talks about his life as a puppeteer and marionettist. It's a puppeteer, actually. And Kiki and Herb, Alive on Broadway. I'm sure you have very different ideas about this.
By the way, Jay Johnson was a ventriloquist.
Mm. Ding! Thank you. That was the word I was looking for.
The scariest.
You don't like Bob? How can you not like
God,
Bob?
Give me nightmares.
Oh, my God.
But not more nightmares than Kiki and Herb gave me.
I hated Kiki and Herb.
Outrageously
just,
awful.
Thank
I
mean, you.
So, just to get back at everybody, I hope they win.
That was painful to sit through.
I love them.
Oh, my God. So do you think...
You've never seen her do a Christmas special and stuff like that.
Yeah, but that's not what they did on Broadway this season.
But it was excruciating.
It just was too long. That was the only problem.
It was 2 hours.
It was about being drunk for 2 hours, and I don't find that funny.
Well, you have to understand Kiki.
I don't even want to bother to try. Do we all thrill that Jay Johnson will win?
There's something about
category?
The Helen Hayes Theater. I think it just attracts the dregs of the theatrical industry.
Oh, Xanadu. I hope Xanadu is really good, though.
Well, that's next season. That's the season coming up. So, anyway.
We can review it now, I think.
Let's move on because we have another special guest already.
We haven't seen it. Let's review it. Xanadu sucks.
Okay, got to take you guys down for a second because we got to get rolling. We got to go on now with another special guest. He is the theater columnist for the New York Post. He's one of the more loved and hated and certainly best known people on Broadway right now who isn't on a Broadway stage.
My mic's off.
Yes. You leaned into the microphone to tell me your microphone's off.
Why is my mic off?
Because I need to get moving, because Michael Regal is going to be talking to us right now.
Michael Regal, let's talk to him.
Okay, let's do that. Well, of all the guests that we've had on this WGBB Tony Award special, the one that we're talking to now, who is not a Tony nominee, maybe the most well-known, the most in some ways beloved, and the most feared and hated, and I think he would like that in some ways, he's the one and only Michael Riedel. He is a columnist for the New York Post. You can also see him every week on public television's Theater Talk, shown on Channel 13 locally, and he's the one and only. That's the only way to describe Michael Riedel. Michael, how you doing?
Listen, the Broadway world could neutralize me if they gave me an honorary Tony Award for services rendered to the New York theater scene.
Well, you know, if you call the Weislers, you seem to be very close with them. They could get it going. Maybe not Liz McCann.
Maybe a petition signed by Bernadette Peters and Donna Murphy, the cast of the Pirate Queen. All my fans.
Somehow I don't think that'll happen, but I'm thrilled to have you as part of our Tony special here, and thank you also for having me on Theater Talk, which is going to air in a few days, apparently, so that was really
cool.
I
don't think we edited you out. I'm not sure, though, but I'll let you know.
And so, Michael, let's get right to it. Let's get to the category that we're going to talk about, Featured Actor in a Musical. Those nominees include Brooks Ashmanskas for Martin Short, Fame Becomes Me.
Christian... Wow, what a legendary performance that is.
Do you even remember
one of
the
most memorable things I've ever seen?
It was a fun show. Come on. It didn't catch on, but I thought it was pretty funny.
Yeah, no, it was kind of a throwback to, sort of old kind of, vaudevillian, review, shtick, maybe sort of like New Faces of 52 or something like that. But I didn't think it was as funny as it as it should have been.
Okay.
But I gotta say, I thought Brooks was fun. He's a solid actor, and we've seen him in a lot of Broadway shows over the years, and you can always count on him to deliver a good supporting performance.
What about Christian Borle in Legally Blonde?
You know, I was never a big Christian Borle fan, I think, because I always found him so weird-looking. He always looked like Marty Feldman in Young Frankenstein with those eyes that go this way and that way. But I thought he was quite charming in Legally Blonde, a show for which I had no use. And it's just a...
Wait a minute. You were beating the drum for Legally Blonde before.
I was never beating the drum. It was the idiot critics in San Francisco who gave it good reviews out there. So my columns had to reflect the fact that it got good reviews out of town, but I always had a sneaking suspicion that when I got to New York, the critics here, who are much smarter and harsher than the critics around the country,
they would
take it down, and I'm happy to say...
Most part. I mean, they were fairly kind, but it's not that... I don't think it's that great.
Nah, it's just a soulless, empty teenage girl show. But, that said, I thought Christian Borle was actually quite winning and charming in it.
So, if you were putting him up against John Cullum, John Gallagher Jr., and David Pitou, what do you think?
You know, John Cullum is in 110 in the Shade, and he's a veteran performer and a terrific old Broadway star. John Gallagher is the wonderful kid with the crazy hair in Spring Awakening, which I think is the best musical by far of the season, and indeed one of the best musicals on Broadway in a good many years. And the third is David Pitou, who got some very, very good reviews playing Bertolt Brecht in Love Music. But for my marks, I thought Pitou was a little too cartoony. I will be voting for John Gallagher, and I think he will win.
I think so too, quite honestly. And it was a really interesting performance, and he was probably the focal point of Spring Awakening as much as the two lead lovers were.
Yeah.
People just followed his story a little bit more. It was a little bit stronger.
Well, his is a tragic tale.
Right. Now, since we've got you and you report on Broadway rather than review it, what would you say are the most important couple of stories, or fun, most enjoyable and exciting stories to come out of the last Broadway season?
Well, I think by far the best gossip story, which I specialize in, was the battle between Scott Rudin, the producer of Deuce, Vertical Hour, and The Year of Magical Thinking, his war against the New York Times, which erupted when Scott decided that he was going to use quotes from the New York Times website in his ads for The Year of Magical Thinking. And what he did was... he went on the Times website, and the Times invites readers to write their own review of a show. And they invite readers to write the review while the show's in previews. And so there were these readers who were writing in about Vanessa Redgrave in The Year of Magical Thinking before the show opened. Some of the readers liked it a lot, and others didn't. And Scott said, okay, well, if it's okay for the Times to review my show on their website, then it seems legitimate for me to take the good quotes out of those reader reviews and run them in ads for the show.
And say that they came from the New York Times.
And say they came from the New York Times, because they're on the New York Times website. And, of course, the Times went completely crazy and had the legal department call Scott and insist that he no longer do this. And there ensued a rather hilarious exchange of letters. There ensued a hilarious exchange of letters between Scott and a fellow named Craig R. Whitney, who is something called the Ethics and Standards Editor at the New York Times. I mean, no wonder the stock price is down at that place. It's so top-heavy with administrators. And, you know, Whitney wrote just these pompous letters about, I remember one quote, he said, "You must understand, Mr. Rudin, that, you know, not everything in the New York Times is of the New York Times," which was a good laugh for all of us who've been following the Times for years. And Scott just fired letters back saying, look, as long as you solicit what you call reader reviews and you run them on the website that is sponsored, promoted, and run by the New York Times, I am well within my rights to quote from a good review for my show on the New York website, on the New York Times website.
So where is that story
Scott
now?
Scott won that battle, and in fact, the New York Times is now reevaluating whether or not they're going to run reader reviews anymore.
Oh, probably.
But, you know, the New York Times, they reevaluate. It means they have to have a committee of other sort of Craig R. Whitneys of the world over there and have lunches and ponder these things before any decisions can be made.
So
in the meantime,
still,
Scott sallies forth, and, you know, The Year of Magical Thinking, which got a mixed review from Ben Brantley in the time, is going to wind up being one of the winners of the season.
What?
Yeah. It'll make its money back.
Oh, no, financially, yeah.
Financially, yeah.
So that was
fun, and it shows you that, you know, with someone like Scott Rudin, who's a powerful, smart, aggressive producer in the mold of David Merrick, he's not afraid to take on the New York Times, and basically to show the world that the New York Times is not the huge power that it once was.
Hmm.
So that was fun. And I think, you know, the other story is, well, you know, once again, Broadway posted record-breaking box office grosses. This is largely due to the fact that they keep raising ticket prices. And we're seeing a situation now where, for a hit show, two-thirds of the orchestra is what they call premium-priced.
So it's even gone beyond the $100, $110.
You're lucky if you get a $100 ticket for a Jersey Boys or a Wicked or something like that. You want to see Jersey Boys on a Saturday night, you're going to be paying $275, $350 for it.
And they've just changed, I think, the scalping rule, too. They're going to strike
that. Yeah, now they basically they are going to allow the theater owners and the producers to become the scalpers themselves.
Well, I guess it's capitalism.
It's capitalism in its rawest form and whatever the market will bear, which is perfectly fine. We live in a capitalist system. But long term, I think you're basically telegraphing, you're telling the world that, look, at Broadway, like most of Manhattan now, is really only for rich people. And, you know, if you're working class, if you're middle class, you know, forget about it. We're not really interested in making it affordable for you to come to Broadway because there are enough people willing to pay the huge prices we're demanding.
Well, thank God you and I can still get in free. That's the main thing.
I got news for you, though. If I didn't have this job and I didn't get those press seats, you wouldn't see me plunking down $350 to see any show.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I think in the long run, I think that is detrimental to the health of Broadway.
Well, speaking
because the worm turns, my friend, and it's not always going to be flush times.
Oh yeah, it'll be well. Okay, I can make a flush joke here, but I'm on my best behavior.
No, let's try to avoid toilet bowl humor.
Totally. Let me ask last question from Michael Regal of the New York Post. What are you looking forward to in 2007-2008?
Well, let's see. Certainly I'm looking forward to Young Frankenstein, the new musical from Mel Brooks and Tom Meehan and Susan Stroman. See if they can match the success of the producers. It's going to be trying out in Seattle in August, and you can be sure I will be there on opening night, filing a report for the Post on the front lines. And I'm curious, although I don't think it's going to be my cup of tea, is Little Mermaid from Disney, because, you know, Disney really flopped out there with Tarzan, the god-awful show from last season, and to my mind, Mary Poppins isn't all that much better. And I think the industry is going to be looking to see if Disney can come up with another winner along the lines of Lion King with Little Mermaid. So that's going to be in Denver in July, and I'm going to head out there to see that. And also, I think I'm headed down to Australia at the end of the month, where I'm going to check out Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, a big multi-million-dollar musical that's starting out in Australia and that's aiming to come to Broadway possibly by the end of next season or the beginning of the following season, 2008.
Uh-huh.
And remember, don't count Australia out. It did give us The Boy from Oz.
Oh. I sure wish they'd give us something else.
But
I'm so glad the New York Post gave us you, Michael Riedel. And
well, I think Theater World shares that sentiment, David.
That's true. And Michael and I have known each other literally from his years in running Theater Week.
That was a long, long time ago.
So it's great to still be your friend.
Well, I remember. You were the intern in the office. You'd give me my coffee, if I remember correctly. Right?
And I spilled it on you. Usually you thought it was an accident, but everyone seems to see that look in my eye. It's like, huh, you're going to like that show, huh?
Yeah, a little Eve Harrington at work right near me at Theater Week. Yeah.
Well, it's all about Eve, you know.
But look, you got a radio show and I don't, so who's the winner?
Well, I'm sure this minute you want one, you'll have one, because that's the way life works for people like Michael Riedel. I don't know why, but it just does. But you know what? You're so charming and you're such a cool guy.
I see what I want, and I go out and I say, "Yeah, not for me."
Well, thanks for being for us on the WGBB Tony Special. Thanks, Michael.
Very fun, David. Thank you.
Bye.
Well, Michael Regal hasn't seen me yet.
Anyway, he has a good life. Maybe he never. No, I don't know what that means. Thank you, Jeff Goodman. He's my co-host along with Simon Saltzman for the third annual WGBB Tony Awards special. That was Michael Regal from the New York Post. We were just listening to giving his thoughts and opinions. We're going to break away now from everything that's happening in this past season because I want to ask my two co-hosts about their memories of going to Broadway when they were really young, like their first Broadway experiences. Simon?
Of course, I have to give away my age doing that, you know. But believe it or not, my very, very first Broadway show was Oklahoma in 1943, and I was years old.
Yeah.
I have a very clear recollection of the opening scene of John Raitt standing at the fence And singing the opening song, and Aunt Ella churning that butter. I don't remember much about the rest of the show, but I remember seeing that. It was the era where the whole family went to the theater. It was nice and cheap.
It was like a quarter, right?
No, I think we paid something like $3.60.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, back, come on, that was 1940. That was money.
1943.
Yeah.
Right. And then I saw subsequently all the Rodgers and Hammerstein shows.
So you
Carousel,
were
Allegro. I was hooked.
What about you,
yeah.
Jeff?
Well, they had candles in the theater. and they only used stones as sets. Now, actually, the first time that I went to the theater, I went with a school trip. I grew up on Long Island, so of course I took a school trip, and I saw 1776 with William Daniels, like Betty Buckley, who was it? Ken Howard. I mean, it was amazing, and I just loved it because I immediately came home and found out that John Adams and I had the same birthday. Which made it even better.
Now, did the other students feel that way, or were you sort of, you were so into it?
Well, they
were
thrilled that John Adams and I had the same birthday.
No, you know what I mean. It's like when you go on a class trip, sometimes all the kids are bored, or they're making fun, or they're
giggling.
No,
I think they're pretty much bored.
I remember standing for 1776, right? Yeah.
Oh, I
couldn't get a seat.
I remember loving it, except I didn't think that there was such accolades. I forget the guy who was doing Ben Franklin. I went, eh. I said, eh, he's Ben Franklin, so what?
Yeah. I think my first Broadway performances were The Magic Show, they took me to, which made something of a
That impression. Wonder.
And, of course, Fiddler on the Roof twice because Zero was in it. And I remember the second time we were all so nervous when they made an announcement in the second half because he was already not so well. And everybody was like, oh, no, he's going to leave. They're going to get the understudy in. And everybody just taking this deep relaxation breath when it was just, I don't know what it was to tell us. This was in the era before cell phones.
Unwrap your candy.
Something, or something along those lines. Or
now,
please come back.
Yeah. I was going to tell you my other stories, because I then went to see, of course, Fiddler, because I'm Jewish.
Right.
And we had to. It was a law, by the way, Saul. We had to sign, contract.
Simon.
What did I say, Saul?
Saul. You keep calling him Saul.
Oh, sorry. Well,
he thinks he's on Second Avenue.
Saul Simon, you know. Anyway, so, you know, after I finished my contractual Fiddler on the Roof, I didn't get to go to the theater because no one really wanted to take me to the theater. As it turns out, my mother wasn't into the theater because her mother was in the theater. My grandmother was an Earl Carroll's Vanities girl as well as a Ziegfeld Follies girl.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
My mother designed hats for the Ziegfeld Follies, Earl Carroll's Vanities, George White's Candles. I should retract that. Not design. She did plumage. She was sent by John and Fredericks, the designer, to South America to purchase plumage for the Follies girls and for the showgirls, and would actually come back and then was taught a trade putting the
plumage. So your mother made my grandmother's plumage?
Exactly. You got it.
Wow.
You got it.
So I feel like we're related.
Right.
Well, and it's also 6 degrees of a kind of thing, because I should mention that I'm host of a different program on WGBB once a week on Sunday nights. It's called Dave's Gone By, and it's a comedy program, a music program, a talk program. And one of our upcoming guests...
All about you, David.
Well, it is, because Julie Wilson, a cabaret legend and an actress on the London stage, and was just talking to her, and she got her start in Earl Carroll's Vanities.
Oh, really?
So it's weird that it just came up the same again today. Kind of cool. Anyway, we've got to get to our next...
I didn't finish my story. Everyone interrupted me.
Well, sorry, but we've got to get on to
save
our
it
next...
For next year.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Saul. Our next Tony nominee, well, our first Tony nominee, our next guest, is the choreographer of Spring Awakening. So that's a pretty exciting show with a pretty exciting choreography. He may even win, which would be kind of cool. So his name is Bill T. Jones. He's come out of the dance world, mostly, to start doing. This is his
Hang on the phone, Michael. We'll get to you.
We'll get to you.
You know, it's what he did with the hands in
this
show.
Yes.
Forget the feet. It was the hands.
That was thrilling. Well, let's ask him himself. Here's Bill T. Jones. Well, it is the show with perhaps the biggest buzz of all the shows that opened this past season on Broadway. And in a lot of the ways, the most exciting show and one of the most thrilling parts of it, of Spring Awakening, is the choreography, which is somewhat different from what you would normally see in a Broadway musical. And the person responsible for it is on the phone with us now. His name is Bill T. Jones. He's been a choreographer for quite a while, and we're going to be talking to him right now on the Tony Special. Hello, Bill.
Oh, hi. How you doing? Great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. So, is this your first Tony nomination? Is it your first Broadway show as well?
Yes, it is. It is. I have worked off Broadway, of course, but I've never worked on Broadway, and it's very exciting.
Well, how is working on a Broadway level musical different from working on an off Broadway one?
Well, I must say that this show was so disciplined and so experimental, even down at the Atlantic Theater, bless them for believing in the show, that there wasn't a great sea change in the way we worked. The writers, the director, and the producers did want to reemphasize certain things in moving it to Broadway. I believe they expanded the cast a bit. We have more swings. We have more musicians. But for the most part, it really has been able to retain that feeling it had down at the Atlantic Theater.
And were you with it from the very, very beginning stages when Steven Sager and Duncan Sheik were first working on the musical, or at what point?
No, I was not. I understand that they worked on this for about 6 years. I think it's the eighth year now, mm-hmm. Before it got to its present stage. And I was invited in, I believe, February of 2006.
2006. So had there already been some choreography done, or did you come in with a clean slate?
I don't think there had been any choreography done. I know there was a staged reading of the work up at Lincoln Center, and that was where the music I first heard. But no, I don't believe there was any choreography.
And I know it's kind of hard to describe something that is so physical and involves movement, but when you heard the songs and when you knew what the show was going to be, what was in your mind to work from to create the physicalization of a dance of Spring Awakening?
Well, I think that Michael Mayer gave me a great insight when he said that he would want to, first of all, cast it with people who are very young and not Broadway regulars. And he asked me to look at a clip from some young man on YouTube or MySpace who was literally in his boxer shorts in his bedroom, bopping around a la Napoleon Dynamite style to some innocuous rock song and singing along with it. And he said, I want to get that kind of feeling. Now, of course, our performers have a lot more charisma than that, and it's much more disciplined than that. But I understood what he wanted. He wanted something casual. He didn't want grand jetés. He didn't want pirouettes. He wanted it to feel as real as possible. And then I think what really finished it for me was when he said that at the moments when they would be singing their soul, singing their heart, they would reach inside their jacket or what have you and pull out a microphone. Here they are dressed in period costumes from Bavaria in the late 19th century. So I said, oh, that's where it's going. Gesture was going to be very important. Gesture is something that people can do at any level of skill, and I thought that that was my way in.
Yeah, I noticed also that on a couple of times during the show, you have very specific arm movements from elbow to fingers.
It's
almost like voguing from what I know of dance, it looks like voguing to me.
No.
Was that part of it, or did that come to you as like, oh, I need those arm things?
Mm. Well, it's a vocabulary I have used for a long time. And like I say, in touring around doing contemporary dance and being in residence in a place in the community that maybe does not have a lot of professional dance, but people would like to do something for the stage, you can always ask people to generate their own basic arm gestures or hand gestures, and then you can do quite a few of them. It becomes quite impressive when you see 50, 100, 200 gestures zipping by you like that. This is the idea. This is the basic way I would start with people who are non-dancers. There was something about the fragility of that first scene with beautiful, virginal Vendra, and she is standing in front of a mirror looking at her body, which is, as her mother says, in bloom, and she is sort of singing to her mother, but I think she's actually singing to her future and her destiny, and she sort of begins to do these simple gestures, and I say that the gestures are speaking, her body is speaking in ways that she doesn't know it can speak, and it's asking questions that she does not know she has. So that's how the gestures begin, simple, almost absent-minded movements around a young body that is changing. these gestures then become a language that unifies all of the young people as the piece goes on.
Man, that is great, great explanation. I wish I were writing a textbook about it, because I would just excerpt that paragraph right there. That was beautiful. Let me ask you then also about the beginnings of your career and how you became a choreographer to begin with. Were you a dancer first and then blah, blah? Blah, 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 as the song goes.
You have to realize I come from a farming community in upstate New York, German, Italian, potato farmers. The town next to us was Naples, New York, with grapes and so on. My parents were there as migrant workers. In answer to your question, no, there was no modern dance there. There was, in the next town 10 miles away or so, there was tap class. There were tap classes that I understood, but my parents were too busy working in the fields or wherever. We were never taken. I always wanted to. I did have drama clubs. Now, that was great. Mary Lee Shapey, may you rest in heaven. She was my drama teacher. And she saw that the show-off that I was needed some direction. And so she allowed me to do public speaking, and I was in debate club. And I was actually in Oklahoma at our high school production. I did the Buddy Hackett role of
Shapoopy.
You want me to sing it for you?
Yes. Come on, you got to do a line of Shapoopy. Come on.
Oh, woman who kissed on the very first day is usually a hussy. That's the first line. But anyways, I was just sort of feeling the ham. My inner ham wanted to get out, and so stage was a good place for that. But I was primarily interested in being an actor and an athlete. I went to the university with that idea in mind, and I got sidetracked, or I should say sidewhacked, by modern dance. I fell in love with it. As I've said many times, the sweaty epiphany that came with really working in a non-competitive way, unlike the track and field, but it was a way with another kind of sweat. It was more poetic. And then I was hooked. Dance was my world, and choreography came a bit later. At first, it was just about being fabulous on stage, you know. But later on, I understood it was a language and a history, and I wanted to know more about that language.
Well, up until, I guess, Spring Awakening, if people knew you a little bit further than inner dance circles, it would be for your work with Arnie Zane.
Yes, it's true. Arnie Zane was my co-founder and my companion from 1970, maybe fall of 1970 until he died in 1988, and the company keeps his name, Dolte Jones, Arnie Zane Dance Company.
Right. And how would you describe the style that you guys pioneered and that you still work in?
Well, it has changed, as all things have changed, my body in particular. But we started out interested in a certain, it was always gestural-based, a lot of gesture, but we were also interested in what we called a kind of naturalistic virtuosity. Now, what that meant was we did sandlot gymnastics. We crashed and jumped around, and we were also practitioners of something called contact improvisation, which was based on principles of leverage, counterpull. So literally, anybody could dance with anybody. It was very democratic. I remember once being through, this woman was able to do it through leverage. She was a 98-pound former ballerina.
Yeah.
She and I were dancing, and she had me completely up on her back just because of the way she would use leverage, almost like jiu-jitsu or something. And that was a great liberating device that taught us that we could think differently about partnering. It didn't mean there was the big brutish male dancer partnering the sylph-like woman on her toes. It could be anybody working with anybody. And that style has informed our whole thinking about the stage, actually.
Can you name any specific choreographers, either in the modern dance world or in the theater world, that were huge influences on you or Broadway shows?
Well, I'll tell you. You have to imagine being a young black boy and upstate New York in 1962 and leaving the Wayland Cinema. I don't think it's even a cinema anymore there. And we had just seen Jerome Robbins' West Side Story. My brother Azo and I, who were basketball players, and we were so impressed with those Jets who were able to turn two, three times. And we were running down the street pretending we were Jets and doing what we thought was jetés and all. That might have been my first choreographic exploration other than the June Taylor dancers on the Jackie Gleason show, but that didn't stick in the same way. It was when I was in the university, I was introduced to West African, African-Caribbean dance by Percival Board. Merce Cunningham to date is probably the choreographer I have the most respect for because he's taken this very potentially esoteric dance form, and he's made a language and a lifetime preoccupation with it that has inspired many people. I wouldn't be where I am right now without the likes of Alvin Ailey. I never danced with Alvin, but Alvin was very kind to me, and he spoke to certain parts of my experience that that helped me have the courage to do what I'm doing. And right now, I am really crazy to see what is happening with the likes of Billy Forsythe, John Jasper, Tricia Brown. All those people are very, very exciting to me now.
But they're all working still in a dance idiom. Is there anybody working in the theater idiom that you are excited about?
Well, I think Matthew Bourne is very good.
Hmm.
I think he has the ability to tell stories in a really wonderful way, and I think he's a true showman. I think he's the one that probably your theater audience probably knows the best.
From Swan Lake, and he just did Edward Scissorhands.
Yes. Right. I had a great pleasure of sitting on a panel with Jerry Mitchell and Susan Stroman, and I was very moved by hearing the way they talk from the inside about this and the skill that they show. They really know how to tell a story with movement, and I think they're really great.
Well, I hate to wrap this up, but we kind of have to with Bill T. Jones, the Tony-nominated choreographer for Spring Awakening. I guess the usual question is, okay, the show's up, it's running, I'm sure it's going to tour. What you working on now?
Well, I, other than my company, working on a piece called The Quarreling Pair, a crazy puppet play from the 1940s by Jane Bowles, I am also developing a show on the life of the inventor of Afrobeat, Fela Kuti. And those persons out there who know this radical revolutionary, jailed over 200 times, who was trying to talk about a corrupt Nigerian government and making wonderful, do I dare say, kick-ass music.
Yeah.
At the same time, I'm developing a show with the dramaturg Jim Lewis that we hope to be opening maybe in another 2 years.
On Broadway, right?
Yes, off Broadway to begin, but, you know, the sky's the limit.
That's right. And
it's going to be called Fela's Alive.
Fela Alive?
Fela is Alive.
Fela is Alive. Well, you've certainly put a lot of life into Spring Awakening and helped make it a very exciting show.
Oh, I'm so grateful that the way I've been received by the Broadway community. I'm very moved by it.
Well, great. And we're very, very happy to have you as part of the WGBB Tony Special. Best of luck on Tony Night.
Thank you.
Good luck, Bill T. Jones.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Thank you, Bill T. Jones, for being part of the WGBB Tony Award Special. We are here until 10 p.m. talking to all these nominees, all these critics. We'll be playing some Tony-nominated music as well, too, in just a bit. But we've got to roll right into our next interview. So many people calling, so much going on. It's great. Our next guest is Glenn Loney. He's been a critic for many, many years for all sorts of different places. I mean, going back, my gosh, for decades, and he's going to be talking about all the different design categories. So here is Glenn Loney. Well, one of the things that unifies the critics that we've had on this Tony Award special is their years of experience and caring about the theater. But few of the people that we've talked to, for all the experience and background that they've had quite as much as our next guest, Glenn Loney. He has been a critic since 1956, started in Europe, and then by 1960 he was already writing for Life and the New York Herald Tribune. He is currently the senior correspondent for NewYorkTheaterWire.com. That's NY Theater and then a little hyphen wire.com. He also writes for NewYorkMuseums.com. Glenn Loney, thank you so much for joining us on the Tony Special, and you're going to be talking about all the design categories, right?
Yes, and there are a lot of categories there and a lot of nominees.
So let's get right to it. Set design of a play. You've got Coast of Utopia, Journey's End, Radio Golf, and Corum Boy. Your thoughts?
Well, my favorite, of course, is Coast of Utopia. I think the thing is entirely brilliant. The entire production, everything about it was remarkable. And when the Outer Critics Circle gave their awards, Jack O'Brien made a really passionate speech about the need for us to finally do something about a national theater, not to have this desperately looking for money to make these things happen. But the National Theater in London does these marvelous things, and if it hadn't been for them doing it first, we probably never would have seen it.
Hmm.
But what the designers did, not to mention, of course, the cast, the designers made this a really remarkable experience. And the credits there goes to Bob Crowley and Scott Pask, of course, for the scenery. And as we know,
mm-hmm.
the costumes,
Oh, well, yeah, let's go to the costumes. They've got Quorum Boy, Heartbreak House, Inherit the Wind, and again, Coast of Utopia.
Well, my thoughts on the costumes, once again, are that certainly the Coast of Utopia, there was a wide range. One is dealing, of course, with a period work. So we don't have a wide range of different and not particularly bizarre costumes, but I thought they were remarkably well achieved and suggested. Quorum Boy is something really, for me, kind of peculiar, because it was only after I'd seen the show that the producers sent me the book, and after I read the book, I finally understood what was going on there. I mean, there were some dazzling images, but I thought, what is that angel that's flying down out of nowhere? And who is this idiot boy that's praying to her? What's going on here? But it was certainly is a stunning production. But my advice to anyone thinking of going, taking the family, read the novella. It's a children's book. It's easy to read. And all the threads come together very easily. And I think their problem was, as Lord of the Rings is having a little trouble in London at the moment, but mechanical trouble, actually, that the adapters tried to get all the parts of the plot onto that stage, and sometimes you just can't do that without confusing people.
That's true. And by the way, if you're thinking of seeing Quorum Boy, you're too late. It closed last week, I believe.
Oh, it did?
Yeah, May 27th they had posted.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, because certainly a lot of effort went into it. But I suspect that part of the problem was it was pretty difficult to find out what's going on here.
Now, how about, let's keep with the plays for lighting design. You've got Quorum Boy again nominated up against Inherit the Wind, three designers for The Coast of Utopia, and Journey's End, Jason Taylor. Your thoughts about design lighting of a play?
Well, for many years, I'm the oldest living and longest writer for Theatre Crafts magazine, which then became Lighting Design, etc. And one of the principles, of course, about lighting design is the best lighting doesn't call attention to itself, which means that often, because it's not showy, people aren't even aware of how subtly it's used.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for, we could say, things that are kind of obvious about lighting, with Quorum Boy as a play, the lighting was extremely important there, obviously. Coast of Utopia, and there were three. There are three nominees because each one of them was working on a different section of it. But I don't think that show would have worked as well as it did without the brilliant lighting, because much of the set design were set pieces or set props, and if they didn't get illuminated right, and if they didn't disappear, let's say they're still on stage, but the light dies on them, so stagehands don't have to rush on and move them off. The lighting was extremely important in that three-part play. As for Journey's End, well, we're in a dugout underneath the trenches in eastern France. I thought the lighting was, you know, effective. The set was effective, but there's a limit to what you can do with that. And as with Inherit the Wind, there wasn't very much that one might do. But I think probably Coast of Utopia is absolutely the best in the lighting category for that.
And it sounds like the rumble is that it will be a Coast of Utopia kind of sweep for some of the design categories.
Well, I think so, because it was distinguished work that was done. Now, not that the other shows weren't also worthy.
But, yeah, there can only be one winner, unless there's the rare tie. It's just, there's going to be one, and then four also-rans. That's the way it goes, or three also-rans. Now, let's get to the musicals. Again, staying with the design categories with Glenn Loney. Glenn, what do you think of the work on Mary Poppins, Spring Awakening, High Fidelity, and Grey Gardens in terms of their sets?
Well, when I first saw Mary Poppins, I didn't see it in London because the tickets cost too much, and if I don't get a press ticket, I don't go. But when I first saw it, I thought, oh, my goodness, tons of scenery. Look at all the scenery going up and going down. I mean, remarkable what they did, but I was, you know, as an old techie, fascinated by what was happening technically and not paying too much attention to the story and to the music.
Hmm.
Fortunately, they invited me back, and I have to say I liked Mary Poppins a whole lot more the second time around because I was finally paying attention to what was going on. But I think that Bob Crowley has done a brilliant job of designing those settings, the way things move, how things blend in one to another, and also being able to get the solid set stuff out of the way so that Matthew Bourne's dancers can have free range on the stage. Always a difficult thing when you have a musical with a lot of dancing not to block the stage with the sets.
Hmm. What about some of the other categories, though, for set? The other people in the category.
Well, I thought Spring Awakening, it was very clever what they did, because there are essentially some set props on the wall. It was very basic, very elemental, because it focuses really on the kids and the two people who represent the older authority figures,
right.
So that it's really about the action and their feelings. In some cases, and this you find also with John Doyle, say in Company and in the Sweeney Todd, which was also elemental in a way, it really helps to focus attention on what's going on. Sometimes, and this is something I had from John Lee Beatty a long time ago, John had done a beautiful set for something that wasn't working, and I said, but the set is so beautiful. And John said, Glenn, 15 minutes into the production, if something isn't really happening on stage, the best set in the world is not going to save the show.
Oh, very true. Very true. So what about the costume designs of a musical? It's Legally Blonde, Mary Poppins, Spring Awakening, and Grey Gardens.
Well, my favorite was Legally Blonde, and some people thought I was out of my mind, but I really enjoyed that show because I don't go to movies much, and I didn't know there was a movie.
Okay.
I think I know who Reese Witherspoon is. Somebody mentioned her name. But for me, this was an entirely new show. Now, I realize some people were saying, oh, well, you know, the show wasn't as good as the movie. But if you come to it with no preconceptions, I thought, well...
Are you saying that's your favorite show in the category, or are we talking about costumes specifically?
I think it's really almost... Mary Poppins is probably my favorite show, but in terms of the costumes and the sets... in Legally Blonde, I thought they were really wonderful.
Oh.
But in terms of sets, let me see. I don't see that Legally Blonde got a nomination. And that's David Rockwell, who's a genius.
Hmm.
Right?
What about,
He did Hairspray.
What about lighting design of a musical? There you've got Spring Awakening, 110 in the Shade. Finally got that one in there. Mary Poppins and Grey Gardens.
Well, I think probably 110 in the Shade profited greatly because it was a very minimal stage setting from the changes in lighting to highlight things. I think the Christopher Eckerlund's lighting was very effective in that. But certainly Kevin Adams' Spring Awakening once again, because it's really about the characters in movement on that stage. The lighting had to be clever and subtle and fast to keep them in the light, without the audience being aware. I mean, you're not seeing dancing spotlights on the stage.
Right.
And it's very clever to be able to manage that.
So if you had to choose your favorite show, Broadway or off, of the entire season, Glenn Loney, what would it have been?
That's a tough choice, but I think probably The Coast of Utopia. I think it was one of the most important and impressive things that we've done on theater for a long time.
Wow. Well, important and impressive are certainly words we can use to describe our wonderful guest, Glenn Loney. Thanks so much for taking part in the Tony Awards special.
Thank you, Dave. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we are back for the second hour of the WGBB Tony Awards special. I'm Dave Lefkowitz.
Turn on my mic.
I did turn on your mic.
No, you didn't.
Yes.
I suggest you turn it off.
Is my mic on? Oh, yes, it is.
Yes, Jeff. But, of course, you could have waited until I reintroduced you, but no, you had to jump in and mention something about your microphone. So what was so important that you had to tell us at the top of the second hour of the WGBB Tony Awards special?
I was going to tell you how much fun I had during the first hour. I can't believe we're already into hour two.
I know.
But now it's just turn on my mic.
Yeah. Oh, well. And how about you, Simon Saltzman? So thank you so much for being with us.
Or as I'd like to call Saul Simonson.
I still have the same name. Thank you. No, I'm having a wonderful time. Actually, probably the better time is when we're off mic. We're reminiscing
about... Because we don't have to talk to Dave.
We're reminiscing about our favorite flops of all time.
Yeah.
Oh, so clue us in. What were some of the things that we're saying off mic that were about...
Well, the news was my absolute favorite flop with lyrics, disgusting lyrics, where it was a murder mystery with the character named the killer, though, so it kind of dampened the mystery of it. And at one point, the killer commits suicide, and Jeff Conaway of Taxi fame... got to sing to us, and he sang, "Bloodstains and Brain Tissues Splattered Her Dress."
Mm.
Fabulous lyrics, aren't they?
Yeah, I remember it, but not as clearly as you do. But I think one of my fondest memories, though, is Bernadette Peters in La Strada. which was a wonderful musical version. And it closed opening night, but had a wonderful set by Ming Cho Lee. You know why I remember that, but he's a genius.
I remember Ming Cho Lee for his K2 set.
Yeah, oh, right. The tree came up out of the orchestra.
The tree? No, it was a big... The
mountain. No, it was the mountain. It looked like a tree.
The mountain. And it was like...
It was surreal.
It was like all the styrofoam. They had to keep replacing styrofoam every performance.
Well, because they kick it off with their spikes going up there. Any of the other great flops? I mean, you tell us about... We can't, unfortunately, invite our studio audience or our listening
here's
audience.
Here's Where I Belong.
To your party.
A wonderful musical version of East of Eden.
But you attended...
Oh, yeah, well, actually, my
Double
wife
M.
and I were very keen on going to previews of everything.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, the previews were like $4, $4.40.
I'd be keen on going to them, too.
Yeah, as soon as we saw the first ad, and previews were cheaper, as you know,
right,
than the regular performances.
They still should be.
They should be, but they're not.
They're not?
Oh, we didn't discuss Nick and Nora, you know.
That
was watchable.
What's her name? Who was from Guys and Dolls? She just kept being killed.
Faith Prince
just died over and over and over again. Which also leads us to the same theater, Shogun the Musical.
Oh, I remember.
That was a spectacle, though.
Yeah.
It was endurable.
But both of you attended the most famous flop. It probably wasn't the worst flop ever, or the worst play ever.
Are you going to talk about Moose Murders?
I am, of course, talking about Moose Murders at your party. Come on, tell everybody.
Well, we got a hold of the script of Moose Murders, and I made 7 copies so that...
The problem with the script is that there's a little smell coming from it.
Well, there's a
Moose Tracks.
They're still, yeah, right. It's great ice cream, by the way, Moose Tracks.
Yeah.
But, we've been known to have parties where everybody gets a role and we go through the...
You reenact the script of Moose Murders.
Right.
And you both saw the original play. I'm sure it was bad. But is it as bad as legend has made it?
Well, what happened is it wasn't supposed to be funny, but it was hilarious.
Oh, it wasn't supposed to be a comedy?
No.
Oh, I thought
it was a murder mystery produced by some oil magnate from out west. It was his first venture.
And his last.
right. No, it was impossible. It was really bad.
Oh, goodness gracious. Well,
it was like the country band Jamboree gone way weird.
Well, we're going to be talking about mostly good things on this third annual Tony Award special, and we've got more good stuff coming up. What we're doing is we're talking to Tony nominees. We also have theater critics and experts calling in and giving their picks and predictions on all the different Tony categories. So coming up right now, we have a Connecticut theater critic, an Outer Critics Circle member. In fact, she's a nominator. Her name is Rosalind Friedman. She's also on WMNR in Connecticut. What was that, Jeff?
Her again?
Yeah, I think she was also...
Have you been turning off my mic?
Yes, I've been turning because we kind of need to move forward. And if we just start talking theater, then we'll never get all these guests in. So,
but we haven't been... It's been 1 hour, and we haven't made a prediction yet.
Well, that's what all these other people are there to do.
What are we here to do?
I'm not even sure. That's why I'm turning your mics off.
I mean, right?
Yeah, you're there to eat. And thanks for the massages. They've been very good because I've got this...
You got the fat man in just to eat? Here, Jeff, eat. Okay.
There you go. Anyway, we're moving on to Rosalind Friedman from Connecticut. She's going to be talking about best book of a musical and best performance by a leading actor in a musical. Rosalind Friedman. She's been a critic for nearly 3 decades now. You can hear her on WMNR in Monroe, Connecticut. And she's also on the nominating board of the Outer Critics Circle, which, of course, our own Simon Saltzman will be very familiar with. So, Rosalind, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine, David. This is an exciting part of the year. We hate to give awards, but we love to.
Well, wait, why do we hate to give awards?
Oh, it's so hard to make those decisions.
Well, you're lucky. When a category is a tough one, sometimes it's like, well, I don't know if anybody in this category should be getting anything, but most of the time it's a pretty exciting thing to do. So we're going to be talking about 2 different categories in this year's Tony Awards, the first one being Best Book of a Musical. And the nominees are Curtains by Rupert Holmes and Peter Stone, Grey Gardens by Doug Wright, Legally Blonde, the musical by Heather Hatch, and Spring Awakening by Stephen Sater. Roz, take it away.
All of them are challenging in different ways. I don't really think that curtains really belongs in that category, but...
Because it's just not as good?
No, I don't think it is.
Okay.
I think that Rupert Holmes took over when Peter Stone passed away, which was very unfortunate. There were many people working on this show, and it seems that there are three plots at least going on at the same time in this book. And I found that very distressing. I don't know about others, but I think the paucity of really great musicals, in a sense, maybe keeps this going. It's entertaining. It's like, I think it's kind of the salesman musical that people used to say you could bring the salesman to these musicals.
Yeah, the tired businessman kind of thing. Yeah.
A Western, you know, it's a spoof on a Western. It's a mystery, and it's a behind-the-scenes look. To me, it just didn't congeal as much as I would like. It didn't hang together.
Okay.
Then we have Grey Gardens by Doug Wright. Now, Grey Gardens is based on this fantastic story, a real story of the Beale family, the mother and the daughter. And it's so bizarre, and it's so quirky, and it's so wonderful, I felt that it was, the first time I saw it was Off-Broadway, and the Outer Critics Circle gave it its Best Musical Award. So we couldn't vote on it again this year because it moved to Broadway.
Right.
I went to see it again on Broadway, and I was the first time I saw it, I had mixed emotions about it because the first act is so completely different than the second act.
True.
Quite jarring in terms of a book. But the second time I saw it, I was so taken with this show that I can't get this song, a song in it, out of my head. But we'll talk about that.
Yeah, which song?
It's called Around the World.
We're going to play that in the show. Yay! In our special, we're playing that song. I picked that one because it's so pretty. And
well,
it also tells so much about her.
I congratulate you, and we didn't discuss this ahead of time, but I just think that this song, sung by...
Christine Ebersole.
Pardon? Christine Ebersole. It's just one of the most beautiful things. It's a classic. And there are very few songs in any of the shows that you could say are classics anymore.
Hmm.
Right?
Well, let's get on to the other nominees in the category. I mean,
yes.
It sounds like Grey Gardens would be your choice for best book. But the Legally Blonde you didn't get a chance to see yet. But what about Spring Awakening?
Well, Spring Awakening was so fascinating. And I thought that I would just read to you what I said in my opening paragraph about this, because it says, it sheds a bright light on the birds and bees in ways that writers like Rodgers and Hammerstein could never have imagined. Gone is the romance of lovers coyly singing, "Don't throw bouquets at me. People will say we're in love." Instead, the songs are "Mama Who Bore Me," "The Bitch of Living," "Touch Me," and "The World of Your Body." And in the second act, there is actually a song with the F expletive word in its title.
Right, thanks for not saying it.
I'm on a public radio station and I can't say the word.
Right.
But the book itself is captivating, very captivating. It's old-fashioned. As you know, it's based on that 1891 German play by Frank Wedekind.
Right, which is not an old-fashioned play at all. It was a very newfangled and still a very avant-garde piece, even today, 100 years later. There's
exactly.
Nothing old-fashioned about it.
It's so contemporary. We think that we've learned a lot and we've done a lot that we haven't got anywhere. But
so if you were voting, would you vote for Grey Gardens or Spring Awakening for the Tonys?
Well, I am definitely for the Grey Gardens. I'm definitely for Grey Gardens.
Which do you think will win?
I don't know. Spring Awakening has quite a rush. It seems to have had quite a push going for it. But I can't really predict. You never know.
Well, let's move on to performance by...
I do have one question.
Sure.
And that is, why was Mary Poppins left off this? Because it was nominated for a Best Musical.
Hmm.
Why didn't it get a nod? Because I thought the book and the development of that was very interesting.
Huh.
You know,
as
a darker piece, more psychological, not just the superficial Mary Poppins story that we know.
Yeah, maybe a lot of people just felt, I don't know, it was the movie was already a musical, and therefore they didn't feel like enough was done to translate it to a regular Broadway musical, as opposed to, say, Legally Blonde, which was a play, or excuse me,
it was
a non-musical movie. I don't know. It is a good question. We do have to move on to leading actor in a musical, which include Michael Cerveris, Love Music, Raul Esparza Company, Jonathan Groff, Spring Awakening, Gavin Lee, Mary Poppins, and David Hyde Pierce in Curtains. Rosalind Friedman, talk to us.
Well, they're wonderful. Each one of these gentlemen are gifted, young, marvelous actors, dancers, in many different ways. I mean, Michael Cerveris didn't really dance in Love Music. He barely moved, but that's another story. Gavin Lee was spectacular in Mary Poppins, charming and a wonderful dancer, and certainly delivered the role. Has a lot to live up to, but did a good job.
Well, yes, the Dick Van Dyke part in the movie. Right.
Michael Cerveris, one of the Love Music is one of the oddest pieces I've seen.
Yeah.
I thought it was very stagnant.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that it was much too much with a German accent.
Mm-hmm.
He's an excellent actor, Michael, a wonderful musician. Every role that he plays is different.
And he was so great in Sweeney last year, but I think
marvelous.
That's what would have been his...
Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. Raul Esparza was amazing in Company, which is a beautiful production. He's so talented. He's so gifted. And, I'm sure that if he deserves to win the award... But I'll take a break on that for 1 minute.
Sure.
Jonathan Groff was delightful in Spring Awakening, a very talented, gifted young man, but I don't think he earned the award in that show because there were so many other good performances.
Right.
And of all things, I fell in love with David Hyde Pierce.
Yeah, he was very funny. He holds the stage. He's great.
On the stage, he is so gifted. He is so comfortable. Everything he does is so adorable.
Yes.
And he really makes that show. I think without him, Curtin would be absolutely a bust.
Well, him and Edward Hibbert.
Oh, yeah.
Every time Hibbert
opened. But Edward Hibbert is always Edward Hibbert. He does the same thing in every show.
So let me ask you, though, if you were voting, would you vote for...
I'm torn. I'm torn between Raul Esparza and David Hyde Pierce. I don't think David Hyde Pierce is going to win. I think Raul Esparza, probably because he starts in the show, he's on stage the entire time, he plays the piano, he sings, he has a concept, it's a true line, the production is wonderful, and so because of all those things, I imagine that, I think he deserves it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been an Esparza fan for a few years now, he amazes me, I think he's tremendous.
And I did meet him at the Out of Critics, and I am amazed, he's a lovely, lovely young man.
Oh, that's great. Now, we have just about another minute left. Please tell everybody what your favorite show of the year was. Was it Grey Gardens, or what?
Well, I just saw Grey Gardens was wonderful. Seeing it again on Broadway, I'm convinced that it's still, as far as a musical, as far as a play, I love Journey's End.
Ah, yes.
And I am very disappointed that it's receiving so little audience attention, as they say.
Yeah.
It's a marvelous piece.
And do you have a favorite performance? Now, this can be Broadway or off, just your favorite personal watch-along.
It's Christine Ebersole.
Uh-huh.
Because I think she's extraordinary, but there's one other person, and I haven't mentioned her, and she has to be mentioned, Audra McDonald.
Ah, yes.
I think she, in this, whatever she does, it's special. And really and truly, the play that she did, the production of 110 in the Shade, it's cute, it's charming, a little high school, a little light. She is phenomenal in it, and her development of the character. She's too good for the role, but... she's just marvelous. So I think, those two really hit me the hardest when it came to performances. And I think always that we have to remember the extraordinary talents that we're dealing with here.
Oh, completely. And I think as critics, we're really trying to keep that in mind, even when we're being a little snarky or picking one over the other. We realize
that's exactly a high
level of work we're dealing with.
I have a quote. Do we have 1 second?
Real quick.
Doug Wright, who wrote the book for Grey Gardens, said the following, "No human appetite is too base. No idea so holy, no institution so revered that it should be spared art's scrutiny."
Well, that's what we're doing here on the Tony Award special. I want to thank so much Rosalind Friedman for helping us scrutinize the Broadway categories.
Exactly. Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great. Thanks, Ros.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, we have a live guest with us on the telephone. Jeff, you might know this person.
Never heard of anybody. We get to talk now?
We actually get to talk now, but what we're going to be talking about is best revival of a play and best revival of a musical, and we're going to do that with Jeff's co-host on a show called Two on the Isle. It airs weekly on Manhattan Cable Television.
The best theater show ever, by the way.
Is it really?
Yes.
Tell us about it, Jeff.
I'm on it, and that's all you should know.
Okay, good enough. Charlie, maybe you can be a little more specific. Charlie Gross?
Two on the Isle actually is on every other every other Friday night, 8 o'clock. We were on Channel 57. We've just moved to Channel 56. Now, if you can't wait until Friday night, you can see us on YouTube, www.youtube.com.
Is it up, Charlie? We looked for it the other day. It wasn't up.
You, well, look a little harder. Type Two on the Isle in the browser.
No, I mean, we were looking for the Tony special that we did. Is
Tony
that up
special
now?
Has not been posted yet, unfortunately.
Ah, okay.
Because we had to rush the only copy of the tape that we had right from the studio in to the broadcast center, so it could be broadcast last Friday. The Tony show should be on...
It's just about secret is the final episode of The Sopranos, right?
When is the final episode of The Sopranos?
Oh, the top is the Tony Awards. What else should it be opposite?
Well, so the Tony Awards are like a four rating.
Our Tony show will be on YouTube no later than Wednesday.
Oh, good.
Ooh.
Good. So all you got to do is go do a Google search on YouTube.
Right.
Of
just
Two on the Isle.
Two on the Isle. You can type in Jeff Goodman. You can type in Charles Gross.
And occasionally
you can even
Dave
type
Lefkowitz.
In David Lefkowitz. Yes, fans of Mr. Dave's Gone By. You can actually see the face behind the voice because as he has pretty much for every year since we've been doing our Tony show, Dave joins us.
That's true.
So you can see...
If you want to crack your computer screen and see my face, that's the way to do it.
Well, guys, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised with what you see. And ladies, I'm afraid he's taken. but Jeff's available, so...
This is true. We can try and hook up Jeff with theater lovers if you're out there. But we got to get to our categories. We've got to get rolling. So
we're having our annual data critic.
Best revival of a play. Let's start with that. The nominated
are,
yes, Inherit the Wind, Journey's End, Talk Radio, and Translations.
You know, so, you know what I'm noticing here, looking at the four nominees, is that Journey's End is probably going to win, but nobody really saw it, you know. You realize that it was so dark, you really couldn't see what was on the stage. And Translations, nobody could understand a word that was being spoken.
I know you're being exaggerating and being facetious.
I couldn't understand
translation?
No, not at all.
Oh, my. Oh, well.
Talk Radio has Liev Schreiber, who is just so incredible. It gives such a strong tour de force performance in a good play, but not a great play. You have two really good plays here, neither of which have been seen on Broadway in some time. Journey's End and Inherit the Wind.
Well, Inherit the Wind
was on recently.
George C. Scott was in that last one just before he died.
And how long ago was that?
Less than 10 years.
Okay, well,
had to be.
That's still a while ago, and it was not a long run. And I think given that we have a war going on, the show, which is not judgmental about war, but just tries to give you an idea of what it's like to be on the front line, and does a very good job of it, I think hits home a lot harder than it might at some other time. Inherit the Wind, which is, of course, the famous creationism versus evolution
trial. Scopes Monkey Trial.
Scopes Monkey Trial, which was...
But fictionalized, yeah.
Yeah, well, fictionalized, which was evolution versus creationism. It gives two really strong performances, Christopher Plummer and...
Charles Durning. It's Brian Dennehy. I always confuse them, yeah.
Charles Durning was in the previous
revival.
A really strong play, and I would not be disappointed to see Inherit the Wind. To see Inherit the Wind win the Tony.
Well,
I think it will be
but great. Ironically, Journey's End will close and then win the Tony.
It will. Journey's End is closing on Tony night, June 10th.
Which is very ironic.
And Inherit the Wind, I don't know, I love the two main performers, but some other aspects of that revival kind of left me cold. Dennis O'Hare, I think I've mentioned this a few times. What was he doing in that show?
He was doing the Dennis O'Hare bit.
Yeah, I mean, it had no connection to anything on planet Earth.
He's a wonderful actor, but somebody had to rein him in.
Yeah, weird. Okay, let's get to the musicals. Best revival of a musical.
This is where you have to remember the term best revival. Because of the shows, The Apple Tree, A Chorus Line Company, 110 in the Shade, by far A Chorus Line, as far as I'm concerned. I don't think A Chorus Line will win, because A Chorus Line that we're seeing now is essentially the same A Chorus Line that originally came to Broadway. They've made no changes, no attempt to update it, no innovations in the staging.
I agree.
And yeah. I have to say that I think that was a good idea, because seeing this revival of A Chorus Line affected me and touched me a lot more than the original production ever did. Now, I'll say I did not see it with the original cast, and that may have been part of it. And also, in this particular instance, I was sitting right, like, in the first row, right next to the stage. I could literally see them sweating. And I think being so close had a certain effect also.
Oh, it can. It totally can. You get where you're placed. I mean, people don't talk about this.
When you're sweat seething, it's always helpful.
And, well, I think it did. In fact, I kind of was fantasizing, okay, this is their... You know, they're coming, they're auditioning. And
I was looking up the girls' dress.
But of course, I'm not a big producer, so I have to keep quiet during the audition.
The ushers kept handing out schmutzbrellas in case people sweating on the front
not,
row.
Not quite.
What about the apple? Why is the apple tree up there?
I don't know.
Well,
and Kristen Chenoweth didn't even get a nomination.
And she was the only reason to see the apple tree.
Yeah, I think that's the egregiously overlooked nomination of the year.
Chenoweth.
She should have been nominated for Best Actress. She was incredible. Yes, she was doing Kristen Chenoweth, but she does it so well. And this really did afford her...
Who else could really do Kristen Chenoweth?
...to show what a talented comedian, actress, singer she is. That said, it is a good revival, but it was never a great show.
And it was an okay revival. I think they spent more than $3 on the scenery and the sets for it, you know? Does anybody have a problem with the fact that Les Mis was not nominated for Best Revival? Because?
Now, well, because, again,
had
the same reaction to this show that I had to A Chorus Line. Yeah, it's the same Les Mis. And it's like, oh, it's a revival? Did it ever leave?
Well, didn't. It was just the touring company came back.
Yeah,
but
it was a trimmed down version.
Like,
yeah, it was trimmed down. But you know, I would have liked to see it once without a turntable. Seriously.
I saw a Les Mis, and I was affected by Les Mis as I've never been before.
Oh.
So
really? Okay.
And, yeah. So to me that says that I can understand why it wasn't nominated, but I'm a little disappointed. Now, you have 110 degrees in the shade.
It's just 110 in the shade.
Yeah, you added some degrees of separation there, but okay.
Okay, 110 in the shade. Now, it doesn't really matter whether they're innovative on this revival or not, because it's been so long since anyone's actually seen it. Most of us have seen it for the first time. This was my first time.
Inga Svensson, I remember fondly.
Well, she still had her leg?
She had beautiful, long blonde hair down her back.
Who was this?
That was the
original, Inga Svensson.
Yeah, ah. She lets down her hair.
And this had Audra McDonald.
Who doesn't let
no,
down
no, but the
her
reason the first wasn't a huge... No, because I read like liner notes and I saw Peter Felicia talk about this particular show, and the original 110 in the Shade, one of the reasons it just didn't become a smash was Inga Svensson hurt herself very badly, falling off the stage at one point, and then they had understudies in, and she was clomping around on a bad leg. So that was what that was about. But what do you think of this revival, Charlie?
I enjoyed it a lot more than I had expected to. I hadn't heard the advance word was not good, but it's a very enjoyable show based on The Rainmaker, and I've always enjoyed The Rainmaker. I enjoyed the score. The story is. Sticks pretty closely to the original play, and it's a nice, pleasant.
But nothing more.
And Richard Nash adapted his own play, you know,
and did a very good job of it.
So where
and it was nice to see John Cullum again. This, you know, he was in two shows this year. He was in this and How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Oh, that's right. I think he was a little more interesting in How the Grinch Stole Christmas, although he's perfectly fine in 110.
Well, in 110, he's pretty much on familiar turf. He's a farmer.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone's ever seen him play a dog before, which is what he did in The Grinch. And yes, he did it very well.
What did you think of Company? That's kind of, we haven't talked about that.
Well,
that's...
I think Company is the one that will win. I don't think it should win, but I think it will win because Sweeney Todd, by the same director, did not win last year.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very innovative company in that, as with Sweeney Todd, John Doyle makes his actors double as musicians. And I loved it in Sweeney Todd. I liked it in Company. I just got the cast recording for this score.
I can't wait till he does it. Got to go disco.
I had a whole new appreciation for the score. But you know what?
What?
I really didn't enjoy this production.
You did or you did not?
I did not.
Oh.
did not.
Now, you liked that other one that they did about at the Roundabout 8 or something years ago with Boy Gings. And see, that one left me totally cold, and I was primed to love Company.
Yeah.
This one I got more into, maybe because I like Raul Esparza so much. Or it was
he made the show. I mean, he was it. He was the first time we saw Bobby as a fully dimensional human being, you know, with all the angst and...
So, Charlie, let me ask you, what was your favorite show of the whole season?
Ooh.
It could be off-Broadway, could be Broadway.
Favorite
Kiki and Herb.
Well, it was certainly not Kiki
and Herb, no.
But it's probably
a
Disney show.
There was actually an off-Broadway show that I liked very much, which unfortunately is no longer playing, called The Accomplices.
Excellent, I agree. One of the best plays of the year.
Yeah.
This is takes place during the Second World War, where a Jewish group is trying to convince the Roosevelt administration to let more people in, more Jews in, basically, or more people in, period, because people are being killed in concentration camps. And you see not only the difficulties they had with the government, but with more mainstream Jewish groups who were just cowered into keeping silent.
Yeah, that's where the title comes in.
You know, the play
in.
Got rave reviews, except from the New York Times, which sent its third or fourth stringer to review it. It was a disgraceful review, didn't get the play at all, and it really...
And that killed
it
its chances.
It killed its
being...
chances. An off-Broadway show has to get a Times review.
I have to be honest, I think it's a good play. I don't think the production was good, and I don't think the production did it justice. It was not directed very well.
Well, I don't think we asked your opinion.
Okay.
Well, I think it may have been loosely directed.
You're taking Jeff lessons now.
To me, it hit home. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb here.
Oh, all right, be careful.
Going back to Broadway.
Yeah.
The musical that I really enjoyed, Raise Yourself.
Mary Poppins. Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah.
Wonderful show.
Oh, and, Charlie, you have a friend and a fan here.
I loved every minute of it.
Yeah. Well, what I liked...
He also liked Chicky Chicky Bang Bang the previous year.
No, I hated that.
Well, oh, okay. John Simon actually liked
would help that.
John Simon actually liked that.
He did. He did like Mary Poppins, yeah.
I meant Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Okay.
He may have liked Mary Poppins also. What I liked about Mary Poppins, number one, it's got that beautiful Sherman Brothers score. This is Spoonful of Sugar, Supercalifragilistic.
Chim Chim Cheree, of course.
You know, I'm very sorry that
Eat
I love to laugh.
They're forgetting Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Well, I thought that they pulled that down a little too much. That got a little overdrawn.
Ironically, Julie Andrews couldn't spell it when it came her turn on Spelling Bee.
I suspect Julie Andrews could have spelled it, but you know what? The spelling was actually kind of boring. I think they did the supercalifragilistic number much better in the film. That's a nice, speedy number. Don't try and slow it down.
Good point.
But that said, what they had to do, you'll notice that there are two producers here, Cameron Mackintosh and Walt Disney, which means it's irrelevant how good or bad the show is, it'll run
Walt's
forever.
Walt's dead. I think it's the Disney company.
But
well, he's frozen. If he's mad, he'll burn up and come back, so yeah.
What they tried to do here was a greater blend of the Disney movie and the P.J. Travin's books. And I think they succeeded.
Yeah, I think they did a good job, too. I don't know if it's my favorite show of the season.
But we certainly hope Rebecca Luker wins.
I think
well, yes, and
Jones. She could definitely win.
Well, Charlie, I'm so glad that you were able to join us as part of the WGBB Tony Awards.
It has been my
special.
Pleasure to have appeared on every one of the WGBB Tony shows.
Our pleasure even more. And thanks, first of all, I've got to do some thank yous already, even though we'll do a bunch at the end of the show. Thank you so much, Jeff, for helping out with some of the food here.
I'm the caterer du jour.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thank you, Simon, for driving 3 hours in terrible traffic to make it here. It's really... we're honored by your presence.
I don't know if it was worth it yet.
Simon is the driver du jour.
Hey, and big thank you to David Hinckley of the Daily News. We were waiting day after day after day. Are we going to get in there? Is he going to mention it? And yes, he gave us a line today. Dave Lefkowitz hosts the annual Tony Awards special tonight, 7 to 10 on WGBB, 1240 a.m. Thank you, David Hinckley.
He forgot me?
Well, I gave him a whole press release. This is what he boils it down to. There's news columns, they shrink. But thanks at least for that much.
Oh, do we get to not thank John Hinckley now?
I don't even know where... I'm not even going there. We're on our best behavior tonight. See, on Dave's Gone By, Sunday nights we can do pretty much anything. But tonight, it's all theater, it's all good talk, including our next guest, who is...
Another guest!
The
when
theater,
do we get to talk to a host? We're far more interesting.
I think everybody on this particular show is equally interesting. I'll give you my real impressions tomorrow.
David,
I know, I'm wiping my nose as we speak. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Portantier, who is the senior editor of TheaterMania.com. He's going to be talking musical stuff, original score, and orchestrations. So stick with us. It's the WGBB Tony Award special. So much more. And here's Michael. Music, music, music. It's all about the music in our next two categories that we're going through on the WGBB Tony Awards special. We're going to talk about the Best Original Score category, as well as Best Orchestrations for this past Broadway season. And helping us do that is the senior editor of TheaterMania.com, Michael Portantier. Michael, how you doing?
Hey, David. Great.
Great. Great to hear from you. Thanks for taking part in all this. And let's go right to the category, Best Original Score. So you've got Curtains, which is Kander and Ebb and Rupert Holmes, going up against Grey Gardens, going up against Legally Blonde the musical, and Spring Awakening. So, do you have any sort of sense of what you think will win or what you hope to win?
Well, in this case, I think it's one and the same. I think it's pretty much a lock for Spring Awakening. There's been a tremendous amount of excitement about the show, really a new style of music on Broadway, and everyone seems to love it. All of the other shows, I would say, got mixed reviews for the scores themselves. I really think it's kind of no contest, you know.
Hmm. And did you, when you saw, because the main competition people would normally say is Grey Gardens, when you saw Grey Gardens before Spring Awakening, was that for you an early leader, or were you kind of unmoved by it?
Well, I think I'm similar to many other people in that I had mixed reactions to it. I liked much of it, but I in particular had a problem with the first act, which I think a lot of other people do. I mean, the score is, in general, is quite well written, but I think they didn't solve all of the structural problems of the show, and that's reflected in the score also. It's interesting they made quite a few changes from the off-Broadway to the Broadway, but I don't think they necessarily improved it. They just changed it.
See, for me, I saw it off-Broadway and on, and I think they improved the first act. They made it go faster, and they streamlined that. But then I felt the second act somehow dragged a bit
that's
more.
Interesting.
So somewhere there's something there that can be worked. And just your thought about, see, for me, Legally Blonde and High Fidelity almost interchangeable. I would have rather seen High Fidelity in this category, I think.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I actually really liked High Fidelity, especially the score. I mean, I think it does have, again, some structural problems. And, it wasn't a hit because of a number of reasons. I think primarily because, well, it didn't have a star in it, and some other reasons. But the score itself and the cast album just came out. It's really terrific. A friend of mine got it, and he said it's the only cast album he's put on his iPod in the last, I don't know, several years.
Everyone I'm talking to obviously has Spring Awakening on their iPod, but it's interesting for him to say that High Fidelity is on his.
Yeah. So that's how much he liked it, and it's really some terrific some work by Tom Kidd and Amanda Green. So I hope that show gets other productions somewhere. It's interesting that I guess maybe not too surprising that Pirate Queen was left out totally.
Mm. If they hadn't done a little thing called Les Mis, it probably would have.
Yeah, I think that maybe the day is over for those guys, at least as far as the critics are concerned. And also, no nomination for the new music in Mary Poppins. That's interesting.
Hmm. Well, I figure what do you think of when you think of Mary Poppins? Chim Chimini, Chim Chimini.
Yeah.
Mean, all the songs you think of immediately were from the movie. That's not fair necessarily, but that's just the way it is.
Yeah. And what was the other show you said that might have...
Well, Legally Blonde did get nominated, but I guess there was another one or two. I'm kind of blanking on them.
And
didn't get there. Well, actually, the Martin Short show.
That had some great new material in it. But, it's not surprising that it wasn't nominated because people thought of it more as a comedy than a musical,
What about Best Orchestrations of the Year? You've got Grey Gardens, Bruce Coughlin, Spring Awakening, Duncan Sheik, and then two from Jonathan Tunick, Love Music and 110 in the Shade.
Well, that's an interesting one. Jonathan Tunick is the acknowledged master of orchestrations. He did win in 1997 for Titanic. I looked that up. And Bruce Coughlin went for Light on the Piazza, so they both won an award. Love Music, Jonathan Tunick might get it for Love Music for being so brilliant and kind of recreating the atmosphere, the chord viol sound.
Mm-hmm.
He might get it for 110 in the Shade because I think The Survival was a very pleasant surprise to a lot of people just in general. And he does really beautiful work in it.
And when you see Jonathan Tunick's name, you sort of know it's going to be a class production and it's going to sound really good.
Yes, and he's very good at a very necessary talent nowadays, somewhat unfortunate, well, quite unfortunate, is to be able to take full orchestrations and reduce them the reduced forces that are used on Broadway nowadays. And it's an unfortunate thing, but at least he's very good at doing it.
Pretty soon all musicals will be scored by synthesizer and oboe. That'll be it. They'll have one oboist.
Interesting how...
That's a concession to equity, yeah.
Interesting how Mary Mitchell Campbell was not nominated for Company. Last year, Sarah Travis was nominated for Sweeney Todd, the other John Doyle show that had the actors on stage playing the instruments. Maybe, I don't know, maybe the nominators are getting tired of that.
I think that's a shame, because, I mean, I think her, if nothing else, the Sorry Grateful on the new Company is gorgeous.
Oh, it's very well done. You know, and one interesting thing is that, interesting thing about the John Doyle shows is that, we may quibble with them for whatever reasons, but it is, I think it's very exciting to actually see the musicians while you're hearing them. You know, I mean, in almost all cases in modern day shows, the musicians are hidden. Either they're in a pit that's totally covered or they're backstage somewhere. So there's this disconnect, you know, with the sound, whereas in the old days you at least, you had the musicians in an open pit at the front of the theater, and that's something that's lost now. It just kind of makes it seem more synthetic, you know, in addition to the
amplification
nowadays. Yeah.
I will say that was one of the real pleasant surprises of 110 in the Shade and the way they do stuff at Studio 54. You see those musicians up in the upper left and upper right in the balcony, and it makes a bit, you hear them beautifully and clearly. And I think that helps a lot.
Yes, and oddly enough, I'm glad you said that, too, because I actually heard some people complain about, I think actually one of the reviews said that the arrangement of musicians when they do musicals at Studio 54, and they put them in the two boxes, as you said, is someone wrote that it was impossible or ridiculous or something like that. I think it's the opposite.
Yeah,
you know,
I love
it. Because they're up there, they amplify them less. And it makes it sound more natural, and it also, there's a really nice stereo effect that happens. And I think it's great.
Okay, speaking of great Michael Portantier, what was your very, very favorite show of the season on or off Broadway?
Well, musical-wise, definitely I would say Spring Awakening. And it's interesting, I saw it off Broadway, and when I saw it there, I was a little disappointed because I guess I know the play very well. I've seen several productions of it in the past few years, in fact, and... they made some decisions that I didn't totally agree with, and also I maybe had something else in mind. But I think between a combination of the fact that they did, again, I believe they made significant changes and improvements in the text and the score from off-Broadway to on-Broadway, and then also I think just getting used to the approach they had taken and, you know, what they had done with it, because it really is very... very innovative and bold and
it's exciting. I thought it was a pretty exciting musical. Now we do have a little bit of time, so I'm going to ask, what was the worst, most awfulest, awful thing you saw all season?
Well, I didn't go back through the entire catalog, so I can't give a definitive answer. But I guess I would have to say that the times they are changing was up there.
Yeah, it was just, I don't know what the hell they were thinking.
Lightning certainly didn't strike twice with for
Twilight Tharp.
Yeah.
But thanks so much for striking us with the lightning of your mind.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was the worst segue of the night, easily. But certainly great to have you as part of the Tony special, Michael Portantier.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks so much.
Here on the Tony Awards special, we have yet another critic and soon-to-be author, because she's working on a book about producers. Her name is Iris Dorbian. She's the editor-in-chief of Stage Directions magazine, and she's here to talk with us about the leading actor and actress in a play categories. Hi, Iris. How you doing?
Okay. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Are you glad the season's over?
It was an interesting season, I must say.
It was very varied. It had a lot of different kinds of things.
Yeah.
So let's go right into the category. For leading actor in a play, the nominees are Boyd Gaines for Journey's End, Frank Langella, Frost Nixon, Brian F. O'Byrne, The Coast of Utopia, Christopher Plummer, Inherit the Wind, and Liev Schreiber, Talk Radio. Iris, your thoughts.
Okay, well, first off, this has got to be the strongest, most competitive best actor category in years.
I agree. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is amazing. In fact, there were even omissions. I mean, like you, Dante, of Journey's End, you could have gone in here.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Nighy of Vertical Hour could have gone in there. And, who was the other one that was really good? But, I mean, this is just such a strong category. However, there is a front runner.
And that would be?
Frank Langella.
Yeah, seems like it.
Yeah.
Why him?
You know, up until I saw Frost Nixon, my favorite for this category was Liev Schreiber, because I think his work is good, but he's never really overwhelmed me. I've always found him kind of antiseptic on stage, but his performance in Talk Radio was just so electric. He just really, truly comes into his own, and I just thought, wow, he's going to run away with the Tony.
And that character is anything but antiseptic. I mean, he's basically in his own filth for 2 hours.
Yeah, he's playing a shock jock.
And then, and it is an exciting performance, but then I had the same reaction. You saw Frank Langella and?
I was swayed to his side. You know, and it's interesting because I had my doubts about him playing Nixon, because Nixon is such a character that is so well known in popular culture, and it's also, he's been caricatured for so many years, so I was expecting a very poor Rich Little impersonation, honestly.
Right.
And thankfully, he didn't do that. He stooped his shoulders, and he lowered his voice in order to convey, you know, the inner conflict of this very troubled man. And he did it so well that you forget, initially it's kind of amusing, but you forget that this is a man who doesn't look anything at all like Nixon.
Actually, well, he's getting a little closer as he gets up in years, but he was once a matinee idol, not too far away from that. And you can say a lot of things about Richard Nixon, but matinee idol would not be the two words you would...
Well, no, I'm just saying this, Frank Langella is, you know, even in his elderly years, is the polar physical opposite of Richard Nixon.
And what did you think of, I thought Christopher Plummer was pretty amazing.
I thought he was wonderful. And I think in any other year without Frank Langella, he would be a serious front runner. Right. I just think he's just extraordinary. And here is a man who was like on the cusp of 80. He must be, what is he, 79 years old?
Something like that, yeah. I don't know.
He gives this wonderfully animated performance.
He's so much fun to watch. That's
so much fun to watch. And he's just so dynamic and charismatic, and he just throws away these lines with such comic proficiency. He's really terrific, and and my hat's off to him, because he's like 79 years old, and he's doing the show 8 times a week.
Yeah, you know, he's not begging for like a 5-performance schedule like some of these actresses who are 25 years old in a musical and have 3 songs, and it's too much for them.
See, I wonder who you're talking about.
No, I don't know. No idea. But we are. Let's talk about actresses in plays now, because the category leading actress in a play features Eve Best in A Moon from the Misbegotten, Swoosie Kurtz, Heartbreak House, Angela Lansbury in Deuce, Vanessa Redgrave, The Year of Magical Thinking, and Julie White, The Little Dog Laughed. Your thoughts?
Well, this is really a 3-person race between Eve Best, Moon from the Misbegotten, Vanessa Redgrave, and Julie White.
Fair enough, yes.
Yeah, this is a 3-person race. No offense to Swoosie Kurtz, wonderful actress. saw that early in this season. I don't think anybody remembers.
No, it wasn't even a good production. It was like, eh. And Angela, what, I don't know why Marion Seldes was left off. I mean,
I guess Angela Lansbury got nominated because she's a legend, and she's Angela Lansbury.
She gets age points. You know, they add the age spots to her tally, but I don't know what that means.
Okay, this is going to be an interesting category. Because I don't really think there's a surefire front runner for this one. I think it's going to come down to sentiment. Maybe like the young guard versus the old guard.
Who would you vote for?
I would vote for Eve Best of Moon from Mistagon. I think she is the saving grace of that production. I think the production is ill-conceived. Kevin Spacey gives this bizarre, hammy performance.
I agree.
Colm Meaney.
Oh, I thought he was Colm Meaney. Yeah.
Colm Meaney, who plays her father. He's very good, but the problem is that he looks too, I know age-wise he can be her father, but he looks too youthful to be her father. I kept thinking that he was her older brother.
Oh.
So, that's how I bought his performance. He's her older brother, and they lost their father when they were young, and he has taken a paternalistic interest in her.
Very, okay.
So, but she's not physically right for Josie. Josie is this big woman, but she gives this wonderful performance. She is truly the saving grace of that show. Vanessa Redgrave and Julie White. Okay. Vanessa Redgrave is a treasure. She's tremendous, but the problem with that show is that I got the sense that it was a reading at Barnes & Noble.
Yes. Agreed.
It was not. I read the book, and because I read the book, I knew what was happening, and I understood it, but if I had not read the book, I would not have had a clue. It was not, because it's not theatrical. It was not written in a theatrical manner. It was not written it was not adapted to the stage well. It felt like a reading.
And you felt, even from her performance, which is very reserved, as befits Joan Didion, I was kind of bored, honestly.
Yeah, it was just like, for example, when she would mention certain things about her husband, how he died and all that, and then I would come out of my stupor, and I would say, oh, yeah, this is the part in the book. Yeah, I remember that.
It's always good in a Broadway show when you come out of your stupor briefly. That should be on the marquees and when they excerpt things for newspapers. Yeah. Came out of stupor briefly for this one.
Yes.
And what about also Julie White, who is, many people say, the saving grace of Little Dog. I mean, Little Dog Laugh was a funny play, but they say she made it.
Okay. I thought she was great, but I also thought she was very hypermanic. And I think
it was a shtick rather than a performance?
Yeah, I thought she was very hypermanic, and it seemed to be at variance with some of the other players, principally the actor who played the hustler.
Right, the guy from
Roseanne,
yes. He was very good. Johnny Galecki.
He was great. She just seemed like a wind-up doll spitting out one-liners. I thought she was very kind of sitcomish, and very mannered.
Okay. Kind of like me in my real life. But, now, we just have about a minute left, so...
I think it's going to come down to the Tony voter sentiment, whether they're going to want to award a newcomer like Eve Best, or old guard, elegant guard and Vanessa Redgrave.
Oh, you think she really has a shot? I think they might go with Best.
I think it's kind of like, I think they might get maybe be swayed by the cachet, of her legend, her reputation. So.
And her anti-Zionism.
Let's not get into that.
Let's not. But let's get into your favorite show of the season, Broadway or off.
Okay, well, there were two shows that I really liked. One show was The American Pilot. That was done earlier in the season at Manhattan Theater Club. It was done in their black box. And American Pilot was about a pilot. American Pilot.
Well, that makes sense.
Lands in this. He just crash lands into this village that seems to be, but they don't quite state, like an Arab village.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't understand what he's saying. He doesn't understand what they're saying, and they're wondering, what are they going to do with him? Should they release him? Should they use him as ransom? What should they do with him?
And amazingly enough, they get Vanessa Redgrave to be the mediator. It's so. And what was your other favorite show?
That was a wonderful show, by the way. Terrific play. I love Spring Awakening.
Ah, okay.
I really love Spring Awakening. I thought it really reinvented, for me, the pop rock musical genre. I can't say that I was thrilled with the book, but the score I just found magical.
It's still in your iPod, right?
Yes.
Well, iPod and all, we are so happy to have Iris Dorbian as part of our Tony special. Iris, best of luck with Stage Directions Magazine. Is there any show you're really excited about for next season?
I'm kind of curious about Rock and Roll, Tom Stoppard's Rock and Roll.
Okay.
I think maybe it's maybe more of the theme as opposed to his writing, because a lot of times with his writing, I think it's just so pedantic, and I just think I'm listening to a dissertation being enacted on stage.
Close in Utopia. Iris Dorbian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the third hour of the WGBB Tony Awards special with me, Dave Lefkowitz, with my co-host Jeff Goodman of Two on the Isle, and also with the president of the Outer Critics Circle, Simon Saltzman. Very happy to have you here. We've been having this wonderful time talking to all these different critics and actors and performers and Tony nominees. We have another Tony nominee coming up this hour, the wonderful Rebecca Luker, who's currently in Mary Poppins. We've talked before to the choreographer for Spring Awakening, Bill T. Jones. We've talked to Michael Riegel of the New York Post. We've talked to a critic from Connecticut, Rosalind Friedman. We've talked to Iris Dorbian of Stage Directions Magazine. We've talked to Richmond Shepherd, owner of the Richmond Shepherd Theater. All these cool people and more to come. We've talked to Glenn Loney, who talked about all the design awards. And Michael Portantier, the senior editor of Theater Mania. More to come tonight on the WGBB Tony Awards special. Thank you so much for joining us. We will be here until 10. Coming up, Ellis Nasour, Rebecca Luker, and more. Let's reintroduce our two people who are busy chatting there. Have you guys acted? Well, I know you have, Jeff, but have you guys been on stage? Have you ever acted?
Actually, I was. I was a member. I went to the dramatic workshop in New York right out of high school.
And you did a Broadway show.
I was
you?
Actually Holden Caulfield in an off Broadway production of Catcher in the Rye.
How long ago was that?
I will tell you, it's 1958.
Okay. Yeah.
I not only was an actor, but I was also a producer, as you know.
No, I didn't remember.
I worked for St. Suber. I was associate producer on Weekend, Gore Vidal's play starring John Forsythe.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and I also gave Raul Julia and Michael Douglas of Filmed Them fame.
Yeah, yeah.
His first job in an off-Broadway show.
What'd he do?
Yeah. Michael, Frank Galliano's City Scene, scored by Mildred Caden. Also starred, it was Michael Douglas, as I said.
Raul Julia.
Raul Julia.
Well, do you have any
Lynn Milgram, and Dominic Chianese, who you know from The Sopranos. They were all in this wonderful
We're
musical.
Not talking about The Sopranos. They're going to kill Tony ratings.
Well, so any particular memories of working for these producers?
They're going to whack Tony ratings, actually.
What?
Yeah, no, Simon, any memories of these actors that you helped work with or got their starts? Or when you were
working for St. Suber as an associate producer, basically, I didn't have much to do with the actors. I had all to do with financing and finding money.
Oh.
You know, I learned how to produce, you know, which is why I went to Off-Broadway producing.
Why didn't you stay with it?
Well, I lost a house.
Oh.
Lost a lot of money. Had a few nervous breakdowns and decided that producing wasn't for me.
That's a pretty good indicator right there. What about you, Jeff? Your stage experience, share with us.
Oh, my big touring company break, where I played Judy from Two Summers.
I assume that was a character name.
It was in Greece.
Oh, okay.
He goes through the magic changes.
Oh, well, there you go.
No, it was a good Judy.
I'm not even And what about Ellard? Isn't that your best
friend? Yes, my two big things, my claim to fame are doing Ellard and The Foreigner. I play retarded awfully well. How odd is that? Although Ellard wasn't really retarded, he's just slow.
Okay.
I used to tell everyone. I said, no, he's not retarded.
But where'd you play that?
That was, again, on tour. You know, it was like Summerstock and stuff like that.
Cool.
And then of course, I redid it on Long Island Community Theater.
Okay, we have to get to our next guest. It's going to be Ellis Nasur. He's an author. He also is a writer of both books, and he's been working on a musical about Patsy Cline forever. Eventually, it's going to come to New York. But Ellis writes for a bunch of different places, and he's going to be talking about leading actress in a musical and featured actress in a musical. Those two categories on the WGBB Tony Show for Mr. Ellis Nasur of BroadwayStars.com. Hello, Ellis. How you doing?
Hi, David. Thank you very much for having me join you.
A pleasure. A pleasure. Now, the first thing you wanted to tell us about, though, since we're talking about the Tony Awards, is just a little bit about the woman who founded them.
Well, it's very difficult to talk about Antoinette briefly, but she was a gorgeous young actress from Denver who came from big money. Her family helped settle Colorado. She came to New York and just snowed everybody, and David Belasco fell in love with her, and he started putting her in all of his plays as an ingenue.
Mm-hmm.
And after she had achieved some degree of stardom, Antoinette had a horrendous stroke. And as a result of that stroke, part of her face was paralyzed and her speech was slightly slurred.
Mm-hmm.
And because of her relationship with a press agent turned producer by the name of Brock Pendleton, she decided she wanted to go into producing. There were only one or two women producers at that time in the late 30s, early 40s, and very few women directors. Antoinette did both, and she had a number of big successes. I guess the biggest success of all was the Broadway show Harvey, which was sold to the movies, and as a result of that sale to the movies and that being a big hit, Antoinette was able to help form the Stage Door Canteen, the scholarship bill for the GIs returning from World War II, and co-founded the American Theater Wing, which is now co-presenter of the Tonys.
So at what point were they named after Antoinette Perry? I mean, how did it...
Very shortly after her death, there was a meeting of the board of the American Theater Wing, and Brock said he wanted to honor Antoinette in some way, and it was suggested that they have an annual award, and we'll call it Tony. It was very interesting. Antoinette always spelled her name T-O-N-I until the big hair permanent product hit the market, and it became so popular on radio and television, she decided she had to put a Y instead of an I. So then after that, she always became Tony with a Y.
Well, go figure. Well, there's your basic thing of how the Tonys were named and kind of came about.
1947 was the first, yeah.
Well, now it's 2007, so all these years later, let's get to some actual categories in this particular Tony Awards.
I think she'd be very, very proud of all the categories because I think you might agree, it's been an incredible season with talent on the stage. The shows haven't always been as great as you want.
Right.
You certainly can't fault the talent. And you want to speak about featured actress in a musical?
I do indeed.
Okay.
Well, let's run down the category first. We have, do you want to read them?
It's up to you.
I think I'll
read them. It's your show.
It's my show. Well, it's my show and your show and everybody who loves theater's show.
We'll take turns.
Okay. Charlotte D'Amboise, A Chorus Line.
Rebecca Luca, Mary Poppins.
Orfeh, Legally Blonde, The Musical.
The Musical. Mary Louise Wilson, Grey Gardens.
And Karen Ziemba, Curtains. Ellis, what are your thoughts?
Well, Charlotte is admired and has a great work ethic. And I don't think there's anybody that wouldn't say that, you know, she really works hard. And what was interesting to me when I recently interviewed her is that she didn't really go out to copy what Donna McKechnie did in the original production, which I think is admirable. However, they're using the same choreography that Michael Bennett, the choreography is being recreated. So she just tried to put a different spin on it. Becca Luker is a Broadway fave. I don't think there's anybody in the theater that doesn't love Rebecca Luker, but let's face it, it's not the greatest part in the world.
I'm just a little sad that, you know, I remember when she was an ingenue and suddenly they're giving her mom roles. When did that happen?
Well, you know what? When we sat down to interview her, she came in She came straight from the house. She had absolutely no makeup on, not even lipstick, and she is still gorgeous.
Oh, good. Oh, I'm so glad to hear it.
Speaking of gorgeous, there's Orfe. She has a couple of powerhouse moments in Legally Blonde, but I don't think it's Orfe's year. Karen with the Z is everybody's favorite. I think she's probably one of the most beloved people in show business.
Mm-hmm.
Still, I think the money's on Mary Louise Wilson. Even basically, you know, she's only in one act of Grey Gardens if you really want to pinpoint it. But I think it's the performance of the season in this category.
Right, and she, the whole act, it's an hour-long act, so
yes,
it's a featured role.
And she's never away for but maybe 5 seconds.
Well, she's mostly in bed. She has to be. And do you think she deserves...
Well rested in act two.
Do you think she deserves the award in the category?
It's such an unusual performance. I mean, I don't know how great the songs are they sing. I mean, you know, they're not the type... They're not the songs that you go down the avenue humming, but I really think that in that category she deserves to win.
Jerry loves my corn. Yeah, I agree as well. Let's get to the leading actress in a musical category.
This is a tough category.
Yeah, it actually rather is. Let's alternate them again. Laura Bell Bundy in Legally Blonde, the musical.
Christine Ebersole, Grey Gardens.
Audra McDonald, 110 in The Shade.
Deborah Monk, Curtains.
And Donna Murphy in Love Music.
Donna certainly reveals a totally different side of her multi-talents in Love Music. And it's certainly a fascinating performance. But I think it would be criminal if Christine Ebersole doesn't get it. You got to remember, though, the show's been running since early in the season.
Mm-hmm.
But recently, they were very smart. They invited all the voters back to see the show again. I happen to be also invited back again, as I think you were, and I think the performance has actually gotten stronger, and especially toward the very end of the second act, I think that it would be absolutely criminal if she doesn't get the Tony. It's the performance to beat. However,
mm-hmm.
since that show opened a couple of weeks ago, 110 in the Shade came on the scene.
Right.
And now you've got Audra McDonald in the mix. And this is a performance also that's mesmerized everybody that's seen it. She's much beloved. She's won a lot of Tonys. It's going to be between the two gals. But I have a feeling that Christine's going to win. But I wouldn't go to Vegas and bet on it. I think that Audra could slip right into that category. How do you feel about that?
It's funny. When the musical first opened, people were literally saying they shouldn't even bother having any other people in the category.
Exactly.
Lock, stock, and barrel, it's Christine Ebersole's show.
The bag.
And it's funny, when I saw the show off-Broadway 2 years ago, whenever it was, I thought she was good. I thought Mary Louise Wilson was just as good. And I thought, okay, it's a really fine performance. I don't know why everybody's screaming and raving. And then I finally saw the documentary Grey Gardens, because I had never seen it before. And I realized, oh my gosh, she really is doing this woman amazingly well. That she's playing, the Beale. And it gave me an extra respect for her of doing the role and also copying but making it her own of this very specific character.
She made it her own.
Yeah.
And, you know, in this category, you've got another performer that everybody in the theater loves, and that's Deborah Monk.
I think that's a featured role.
And, you know, to me, I think we should honor the fact that they put her name over the title. So they put her in the right category, in my opinion. But to a lot of people, she is featured, and of course she did win the Featured Drama Desk Award.
Yeah.
And if she had been in the actress category, that wouldn't have happened.
But
a lot of people are saying that Deborah Monk should have been in the featured category. I don't agree. I think that if you're given star billing, you should be in the star category. And it wouldn't it be funny if all these votes are split and Deborah walks off with the award?
That I don't think will happen. I don't think it's the greatest performance. I think her character is just basically crude and not that funny.
You gotta think about something in this category. You know that the producers and the tour, the theater owners out in America, they control who really wins the Tonys.
Yeah.
And there's only one show in this, there are two shows in this category that they definitely think that could play every city in America, and that's Legally Blonde and Curtains.
Right.
Grey Gardens is not going to be able to play down in Oklahoma and Louisiana and Mississippi and sit down for 2 or 3 months.
Right.
I don't think 110 in the Shade is ever going to tour.
Well, that's a show that could go.
Probably will never get out of New York City.
Well, 110 actually is a musical that technically should be able to tour everywhere.
Yeah,
have
but
school
it's been
groups
probably
and,
almost probably every respectable theater has already done it.
Done it, yeah. I don't know. I
so
mean,
it
I'm,
would be
I'm,
interesting
yeah.
to see if the voters. It's not like the Outer Critics and the Drama Desk where you've got people who write about the theater voting. You've got people with commercial
interests
voting.
I know. Although, oh. And I would not be upset, though, if Audra McDonald took it because she was.
I don't think
magic.
Anybody would.
Yeah.
I just think it would be considered an upset. And right now, it's certainly between Christine and Audra.
Absolutely.
And wouldn't it be nice if that was a tie, like at the Drama
yes.
Desk? Of course, it was a tie between Donna and Audra because Christine had won the previous season. Because
Drama Desk
could,
allows
off
Broadway. Now, speaking of Broadway or off, how about your sense of the best show you saw all season long and maybe the best performance?
Christine Ebersole would be my choice for the best performance.
Mm-hmm.
I was very, very impressed when I saw Curtains in California, but by the time I got back to New York, it had kind of worn a little thin on me. But if you're a show business fanatic, there's a lot to love about it. But I think the best musical of the season is In the Heights, and it will be nominated for Tonys next year because they just announced they're moving it to Broadway after they're going to close it.
Yep.
And in July, they're going to open it on Broadway.
Well, they're closing it in July and then opening it, I think,
open
next
it on
season.
Broadway
yeah.
later, right?
Right.
Yes, that's
yeah.
right.
So,
and they'll probably make some changes. But I tell you, when you walk in that theater on 37th Street and see that set, I think bringing it to Broadway must have always been in the back of their head.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm looking forward to
plays,
that, too.
As far as David, I think the sweep and the epic of Coast of Utopia made it my favorite play. But I was also very, very knocked out by Frost Nixon.
Yeah.
But I think by the performances more than the play.
Okay. Well, Ellis Nasur, it's been a pleasure. Make sure everybody to read his columns on BroadwayStars.com, stars with an S, not a Z. He's also a contributor to Playbill, and he is the author of, please give us the title of your book, Ellis.
Well, it's called Honky Tonk Angel, The Intimate Story of Patsy Cline, which is now being adapted into a musical for the stage. And maybe in the next 20 years it might get nominated. So, David,
yeah.
go back a long ways. I thank you for thinking of me. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Ellis. Have a great one. Bye-bye. Ellis Nasur on the WGBB Tony Award Special here on June 4th on AM 1240 WGBB. Also, should let you know that this whole show is live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. We've got so many thank yous to do in the next half hour, but also still more people to talk to and a little
bit
more co-host.
They're here.
Oh, that's Jeff Goodman talking to us. He is the co-host of Two on the Isle on Manhattan Cable Television bi-weekly, and we also have the president of the Outer Critic Circle, Simon Saltzman. How are you holding up, Simon?
Well, I'm feeling more outer every minute.
That's right. See how I feel?
Well, did you honestly think you were going to be on mic for 3 straight hours?
Yes.
I thought it was an exclusive interview.
I thought it was, I mean, I thought these people would call on live, we could talk to them, but no, you get to talk to Rebecca Luca all by yourself.
Yes, sister. Well, she had to do her interview at a certain time, literally squeeze me in kind of last minute, and I'm very grateful that she...
Well, I'm going to have a little talk with Miss Luca.
Well, we have Rebecca Luca on the line, Tony nominee for Mary Poppins, and the first thing I'm going to do is embarrass her. Because I'm going to read just a little bit from a review that Stephen Holden gave her in the New York Times when she was doing a cabaret show at Feinstein's last year, just around this time.
Oh, my goodness.
You remember? Oh, you must have read this review.
Yes.
A glow of southern warmth along with the confidence of a traditional beauty queen infuse everything she sings. Miss Luca is an ardent champion of new American theater songs, combining an introspective urban sophistication with musical comedy chattiness. Her lyric soprano lends a quality of robust well-being to everything she sings. As her voice swells, it gains in beauty, textural fullness, and emotional power. You never feel she's showing off. Oh, it just goes on and on like that.
That was very, very nice.
You're glowing and compelling. And by the way, you are also 6 degrees of semi-separation from this radio program, because last year, your husband, Danny Burstyn, was on our Tony show.
Yes, he remembers that. He saw your name and he went, oh, yes, I talked to him.
Well, he was great fun. And let me ask you then, does something happen to your household around Tony time, or you've been Tony nominated 2 times already, he's had a Tony nomination, do you just sort of go, oh, it's happened again, and that's it?
Did something happen?
Well, no, I'm saying, how do you, during Tony time, like, do you all get a little hyper, or do you really get worried, and do your agents nag you, or do you just try and let it kind of shrug your shoulders, and if you win, you win, if you lose, you lose?
You know, we definitely shrug our shoulders. We just say, look, we're so lucky to have these jobs that we have and these shows that we love, you know, doing them with the people that we love so much, and that's so true for both of us. And so, you know, I was perfectly prepared this time not to get one. He was prepared last year not to get one. We truly are just so grateful to have what we have. And we think, well, it would be wonderful and it would be icing. But we've been around for a long time doing this, and we know that it is what it is, and things happen, and sometimes they don't. And it doesn't mean a thing, really. It doesn't mean anything about your talent or your ability or how happy you are in your life, you know. So we really do try to just let it roll the way it rolls, and we're really fine either way.
Great. And let me ask, one thing, that you certainly are what we would call a Broadway star, and yet you've not, either by choice or I'm wondering what the choice was, not so much to do a TV sitcom or not to go out to the movies and try and make it there. You've really stayed on Broadway since you started in about 1991 with The Secret Garden. Is that...
I'm laughing because you say it's a choice. Things are so not in our control. I would have done a TV series or more movies, or if I get them, I would do them.
It's
not for lack of trying. It is sort of a timing thing, I believe. I mean, I've sort of, you know, when I've been during pilot season on certain years, I've been very busy doing Broadway musicals and haven't been available. And there have been other times when I've tried, absolutely tried fervently, and haven't gotten one. So, you know, it's just the way the ball's rolled, you know, and I'll just keep trying. I like to do a variety of things, sure. I think most actresses would.
I also assume that because you and Danny are living in New York and you've got stepkids and stuff like that, that it also has to do with staying in New York.
There is that factor, too. My stepkids are here, my Danny's sons, and his family is here, which is also my family, and we have turned down a lot of out-of-town work, both of us. So, yeah, you know, the ideal thing would be to get a New York TV series here, you know.
When Law and Order tries to change one of its leads, you're up there like, please, man.
Danny's done a lot more TV than I have, and that's probably the way it would go, and that would be great. But, yeah, we hate to go out of town for longer than a month or so, and really have been lucky not to have to over the years.
Now, insofar as casting choices that you may or may not also have control of, you started pretty much with Secret Garden, which was a new, quote-unquote, musical.
Yes.
Most of the time, you've ended up in either revivals, I mean, doing terrific work in things like The Music Man and Showboat.
Oh.
And Mary Poppins is a new musical, but it obviously feels not so new because it was a movie and the songs, most of them were written. Do you feel sometimes a little typecast by that? Do you feel you're not considered for brand new musicals and they kind of look for you for revivals?
Oh, that's a tough question. No, I think I am considered for new musicals. It's just, again, I think the timing has been the main culprit, you know, that I've been busy doing something else. When a new musical comes along that I'm right for, and often, you know, as you know, a new musical is, they'll choose the lead that they want, you know,
and no one
is considered, you know, so... No, it would be great to do another new musical. I'd love to do that. I'd love to headline in a new musical or be featured in a new musical. Of the seven I've done, almost half of them have been new. So,
oh,
you know,
okay.
It's hard to remember that, but yes, I mean that's true. I've done seven, and three have been new. So.
And apart from, because obviously you'll have to say Mary Poppins, so we're going to accept that one. Which has been your favorite?
Broadway show with Phantom of the Opera.
Oh my gosh! Who are you?
And then my very next one was The Secret Garden, and yeah, and there were a bunch of revivals in the middle there. But I love doing those too. I mean, it's wonderful to try to reinvent something and to put your own stamp on something. And I like doing them all. I think it's possible to do good work in all of them. And sure. Let's hope that a new one comes down the pike soon, or something else, or a play, or something else. I'm open to all of it, really.
Can I ask how you feel Broadway has changed in, say, the 16, 17 years since you started doing it here?
Oh, my goodness. That's a question.
I know.
That'll take more than 10 minutes. how it's changed. I, you know, in a way, I think it's improved.
Oh, okay.
I think there are more people coming to see Broadway musicals. I mean, you know, against all odds, I think that has really happened. I mean, I started in Phantom in 1988 when there was really sort of a pall over Broadway, especially like maybe the couple of years preceding that. And everyone was worried about it, and,
right.
you know, nothing was happening but the big British, you know, mega hits and things. And I think since then, we, you know, Broadway has changed. There's more openness to new, different types of musicals, you know, a la Spring Awakening and Grey Gardens and things that are sort of on the cusp of, you know, the mainstream hits. And people are responding to those. And I think there are more people coming to Broadway musicals from around the country, I think, than ever. And that is amazing to me, you know, because of videos and movies.
Right.
Computer, you know, everything, you can see everything on a computer. You don't really need to leave your house, and yet people do, and I'm very, you know, heartened by that, really. The younger generation, I think, is we're beginning a new generation of theater lovers.
God willing.
exactly right.
Yeah.
I think that will continue. You know, my stepsons are two of them. You know, they really love Broadway musicals. They love it all. They love, you know, rock music, and they have a you know, a healthy appreciation for a wide variety of music and theater, and I think they're not they're a little bit rare in that way, but there is a generation of young people who are like them.
Great. We have just one or two more minutes with Rebecca Luker, and want to ask, if you were starting up all over again, coming from Alabama, going to New York, what would you do the same, and what might you do differently from what you've done in your career?
Oh my goodness. I would probably take more chances. I would study more. I would study acting more. I would take more dance. I would sort of put myself out there I would try new things. You know. I mean, in a way I can understand why I did what I did and the way my career has gone, and it's been wonderful, not to take away from it. But I always tell young people to try different things and to put themselves out there and to try different kinds of roles, and then you never know what, you know, if you don't try it, you don't know where you're right, your best, you know, abilities lie. And I think I'm much more versatile than I've given myself credit for. And I probably would have done that. I would have studied a lot more acting, I think.
Huh. Well, you've certainly been giving wonderful performances with the acting training that you have. I've got one more question, please.
Absolutely.
It's a fluff ball. You can hit this one out of the park. What's your favorite thing about doing Mary Poppins?
Oh, my goodness. I don't have one favorite thing. I love working with Daniel Jenkins. He's the most wonderful person, and, you know, we're sort of joined at the hip on stage every night, and the kids are lovely. I love everyone in the show. I know this sounds so crazy. You know, Ashley Brown's the funniest woman in the world. I really have to say the people that I come in contact with every day in the show.
That's great. Rebecca Luker, I wish you very, very best of luck in this show and all your future shows, and good luck on Tony Night.
Thank you so much. Talk to you.
Thanks. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Well, we're having a great time here at the Tony Awards special on WGBB, and one of the great exciting things for me is to talk to not only the Tony nominees, but the critics that I meet on the aisles all the time and ask them what they think of the different categories, who they think should win and who they think will win. And joining us now is Jeannie Lieberman. She is the editor of TheaterScene.net. For two decades, she has been a theater critic, and she's a member of the Drama Desk, the Outer Critics Circle, the American Theater Critics Association, just all that background, all that experience to bring to bear on the two categories we'll be talking about, choreography and best performance by a featured actress in a musical. Welcome, Jeannie.
Delighted to be here.
Yeah, and you were on last year. It was great to have you. Great to have you back. Let's get right into it. Best choreography. The categories are, or the people in the category are, Rob Ashford, Curtains, Matthew Bourne and Stephen Mear for Mary Poppins, Bill T. Jones for Spring Awakening, and Jerry Mitchell, Legally Blonde, the musical. Your thoughts?
My thoughts. Well, it's an interesting conglomeration here. Rob Ashford in Curtains is one of our most competent choreographers. He recently won the Tony for Thoroughly Modern Millie, and he also did Wedding Singer, so he's good at period pieces. But I think he was limited in this cliché-filled, old-fashioned Cantor and Ebb musical, Curtains, although I found it most enjoyable and comfortable to watch, but not really Tony material.
Okay.
Jerry Mitchell, Legally Blonde. Well, this is an exciting year for Jerry because it's his first time as a director and choreographer, and he exhibited remarkable constraint, more than he did when he over-choreographed La Cage aux Folles a few seasons ago. But I think he did too good a job because the choreography is no longer a major factor in the show. He actually did a better job in, as his debut as a director of the show, which I also enjoyed. Okay. Bill T. Jones in Spring Awakening. Well, there's a big fuss over his modern minimalist movement, which might seem new to Tony voters, but for dance devotees, it's nothing special. Unless you really admire choreographing boys masturbating, which will probably win for the above reason. But can you just imagine someone in Middle America going to a Tony Award musical and seeing this? A show devoted to masturbation, incest, abuse, suicide, and botched abortions? I don't think so.
Well, I mean, I don't know why that should be influencing whether or not, A, you'd vote for them, or B, whether they should win for their artistic things, especially choreography, too, yeah.
Well, if you take it as straight choreography, there was very little choreography in the show, and it was odd, as was the rest of the show.
So are you saving your favorite for last? Is Mary Poppins your favorite?
Believe it or not. Despite the snob value of elitists against anything Disney, and people who might call this gimmick-filled, I dare anybody not to gasp when Gavin Lee tap dances upside down after walking up and down the sides of the proscenium, or Mary Poppins gliding up the stairs in that adorable house, and, of course, flying to the upper balcony, which is a treat that people in the scholarship seats should have more often.
And actually, if you look closely, she's masturbating while she's flying. It's an amazing sequence.
You're so mean.
I know.
Well, don't forget the dancing statues when they come to life and the chimney sweepers dancing on the roof. So I thought it was very enjoyable and creative. And Matthew Bourne won a Tony for Swan Lake and has recently now done Edward Scissorhands. So he's a pretty well-known... He is my favorite. Bill T. Jones will win.
I think you're right about Bill T. Jones. I don't know that much about dance, so I'm kind of pulling for Bill T. Jones because I found it pretty exciting. Not boys masturbating, but just the fact of...
Watch yourself, darling. Each according to his own taste.
Now stop that. Now let's go... Let's clear away any homophobic or homophilic aura and get to featured actresses. Lots of nice, cute girls and featured actress in a musical category. They include Charlotte d'Amboise for A Chorus Line, Rebecca Luker, Mary Poppins, Orfeh, Legally Blonde the Musical, Mary Louise Wilson, Grey Gardens, and Karen Ziemba for Curtains.
Well, this is a lot of sentimental favorites here, and one newcomer. Charlotte d'Amboise, well, Dad has much to be proud of. Charlotte executes everything perfectly, as we recently saw in the revival of Sweet Charity, but she played the lead only until the Hollywood star came back for her part. So she's adorable and perky, but somehow lacks the spark to ignite the audience that Donna McKechnie had in Original Road of Cassie. Rebecca Luka, Mary Poppins, she's also a most seasoned and delightful performer in the group, but after seeing her in larger and occasionally lead roles in Sound of Music, Music Man, Showboat, and Phantom, it's almost embarrassing to see her in this very constrained minor role of the children's mother. I don't think it's her year. I think she can do better in a better role. The newcomer, Orfeh, in Legally Blonde, well, she's a pop singer-songwriter. She has been in Saturday Night Fever and Footloose, but she was exceptional in Janice, in the off-Broadway show Love, Janice. She does a competent job as the mistreated beauty parlor owner and friend to Elle, the lead. She plays cute, and she's a character part, but I think her best award is having her husband, Andy Carl, in the play with her.
That's right. And also, yes, probably the best press agent on. Nobody
please.
Gets more press than Orfea.
Definitely most formidable.
And it may backfire on her.
I hope not, because she is adorable. It's not her fault she has the best press agent in the world.
So is it Mary Louise Wilson you think will win?
Well, Karen's the M, but don't forget Karen. Karen is everybody's sweetheart in Curtains, in spite of winning many Drama Desk and Out of Critics Circle's awards for Chicago and Crazy for You, etc. She's only won one Tony for Contact.
Oh. She deserved it for Contact.
Oh, she did. She deserves a lot. You know, she's hardworking and very proficient, but she's pushing the edge of the ingenue envelope now, and she's almost like a bridesmaid and almost never the bride.
Yeah.
She seems to lack something, that one outstanding quality that one needs to win. So, the oddest choice, and I do think the winner, will be Mary Louise Wilson on Grey Gardens, who is an insider's favorite, though she only appears in the second half of Grey Gardens.
True, although the second half is over an hour long, so it's enough to be in a full, and it's a featured actress role anyway, so it's not even a lead. Yeah,
yeah, she's like a dancing actor, not an actor. Anyway, she scores a triumph in this slightly deranged, reclusive little lady's mother who eats the cat food and cooks in her bed and controls her unfortunate daughter. I think if Christine Ebersole takes the Tony, she'll surely take Mommy with her.
And would you vote for Mary Louise in this category if you were a Tony voter?
I would vote for Karen Ziemba only because I just feel she deserves it.
Okay, and let's very quickly also ask you about your very favorite show of the whole season, Broadway or off.
Well, my category is musicals. I mean, I love Frost Nixon and Frank Langella. There's hands down, I would see that over and over again, and him, of course.
Mm.
But as far as the musicals go, my favorite musical of the season is In the Heights.
Ah.
It is a hot tamale of a show.
Which is coming to Broadway next season.
Yes, it is. So Tony voters can vote for them next year. And I'm sure that they're going to, I don't know what's coming down the pike, but this show is a winner. It's hot. It's got merengue and salsa and all these Latin rhythms. It's vibrant. It's new.
It really is,
it's
yeah.
It's time for that Latino, not since West Side Story have we seen anything with those rhythms on Broadway. My worst?
Yes. Worst show of the year for you.
Love Music. The guy next to me, a critic, said it was as dry as burnt toast. And I don't think I can better that.
Yeah, it was kind of a bore, wasn't it?
It was a bore, it was odd, it was dull, it was amateurish, and it was peculiar.
Kind of like me.
Oh, David, not you.
Oh, I'm kidding, but you are anything but all of those things. Jeannie Liberman, I want to wish you a very, very happy, not this season also, but next season, and great things with TheaterScene.net and with all the stuff that you're doing. Thanks so much for being part of the WGBB Tony Special.
Thank you, David.
Yes, we are coming to the final minutes of the WGBB Annual Tony Awards Special. We're going to do our thank yous in a little bit, but now, sort of, I'll do a microphone drum roll here, because we're ready for the two big monster categories, the ones they save for 10:55 p.m. on Sunday night. By the way, the Tonys are going to be this coming Sunday night, June 10th, on CBS TV, from 8 to 11.
I didn't know we were going to do Best Orchestration now.
No, we're not doing orchestrations. We're doing Best Play and Best Musical, and Jeff was kidding, making a joke. A funny joke, but a joke at least. Jeff Goodman, my co-host. Simon Saltzman, my co-host. Thanks so much for staying with us to this big, important moment.
The bitter end.
Yeah. Yeah, we were the only people here live, and everyone else got to talk.
Well, okay, now you've got your big time. I saved you guys the big category.
We're the big finish.
So Best Play, the nominees are... Simon, do you want to do the honors?
Absolutely. Oh. The Coast of Utopia.
So, Simon, if you could just move your mouth closer to the microphone, or the microphone closer to your mouth, which would be even better. There you go.
The Coast of Utopia.
There we go.
Frost / Nixon, The Little Dog Laughed, and Radio Golf.
Okay. Now, first of all, before we get to the four that are there, does anybody have a problem with the fact that Corum Boy is not?
No.
Me neither. I'm just saying that seemed like an obvious one, the only obvious one that they kind of left out.
And then they got so upset they closed. Big deal.
Mm. Well, it had 6 nominations in other categories. You know.
But nobody feels that it had any kind of merit as a play that would be Tony-worthy. No. Just checking.
What do you think?
I would have put that instead of Little Dog Laughed myself.
No.
Yes.
I'm no.
Yeah, I mean, Little Dog Laughed has one good scene, the monologue.
I like the little dog laugh.
I think it's a.
Well, okay, so there we have our first. So, Jeff, you're happy that Little Dog Laughed is on the list. But you wouldn't vote for that for if you were a Tony voter for Best Play, would you?
No.
What would you vote for?
I'd probably Coast to Utopia, just because it's Memopoly or whatever you want to call it. It's just such a big thing.
So just the length, just the size of it, that's.
Yeah, I mean, it really was, you know.
What?
A big production.
Oh boy, were you excited by it? Did you like it? Did you see all three parts?
I didn't get to see all three parts.
Would you have liked Radio Golf if they had done all 20 hours in one?
I would have loved that. Oh, I think I definitely would love that.
You know, when you think about it, this chronicle of the African American experience in the United States over the entire century.
Oh, it's an extraordinary work. So is Radio Golf yours?
I mean, in a sense, it's the same kind of thing that Coast of Utopia is on a much bigger scale. But
I think that's what's going to win. Because it's just such a mammoth.
I would just love to see Radio Golf take the Tony. But
so that would be your choice.
That would be my personal choice. Yeah.
Radio Golf, yeah, but it's still not his best play. And I would rather see him not win this year and next year give him a special posthumous Tony for his whole cycle.
Well, shouldn't they have done that this year? Is it next year already too late?
No, because this year he still has Radio Golf, which can.
Frankly,
I think I'd like to see them exclude British entries and have a separate category for American.
Well, the New York Drama Critics Circle does that. They have best foreign play.
Yes, I think that's very intelligent. Yeah. Because, you know, every year at the end of the season in the spring, we get the British snob hits come over and dominate that whole category.
Yes.
Rightly or wrongly. Yeah.
Like History Boys. I did not like that.
I didn't either.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get to the musicals, though. That's a fairly American category, I think. This year we got Jeff, why don't you read
except for Mary Poppins.
Except it comes from Disney more than Travers. But go.
Curtains, Grey Gardens, Mary Poppins, and Spring Awakening.
Okay.
And we're all very worthy.
Anyone who's ever tuned in knows where I stand.
Yeah. Jeff has been a huge... we went to see Spring Awakening together, and he's been a huge proponent of it ever since.
He couldn't stop it. It was literally on my car CD for months. I mean, I listened to nothing else. I was immersed in Spring Awakening.
However, Simon, the score isn't something that I want to hear over and over and over again. It's a good score.
This may be a generation gap, though. Cause,
it could be, because as far as listening music, I really enjoy Mary Poppins. I think the Sherman Brothers have done a fantastic
job. Well, nice, but, first of all, most of the stuff was
six
not...
Six additional songs, by the way, to the original.
Yeah, but most of it was not written, and the better songs were not written
for the stage. That's an interesting question. Is Mary Poppins worthy of, say, best musical or best score and all that stuff for the six songs that they wrote for now rather than the whole score or the stuff that was from the movie?
Well, I think you have to include the entire score, plus the six additional songs, and I think it is the best score.
Now, what's interesting is, in the early part of the season, Grey Gardens seemed to be the big thing to beat.
Okay, see, there I lied already.
What?
Grey Gardens is the best score. I mean,
Charlie tried to talk into stupid...
No, that was... Grey Gardens was a phenomenal score. I mean, when you think of the style of the 30s that's used for Big Edie, the style of 40s for Little Edie in the first act, and then you go into the contemporary flavor of the music in the second. It's an extraordinary accomplishment.
It's a great piece. I wish it could win Best Score, but it's just going to be a Spring Awakening sweep.
I'm sure you're right.
Including for Best Musical. Now, does anybody have a problem with High Fidelity not being on the list as opposed
great
to...
Great lyrics in that show. Absolutely great lyrics. I can't sing your other songs, but those wonderful, dirty lyrics.
Yeah, we ran
I have a problem that Martin Short was omitted.
I agree.
Mm. from at least songs, if not the actual best musical,
yeah,
or a specialty category. I don't know
and
why.
And best
they...
male performance,
yeah,
in a musical. He was phenomenal, as were the supporting cast.
Well, that would have been a great ensemble. See, they should give an ensemble.
I agree.
What about Legally Blonde? That's not in this category either for best musical.
That's okay.
That's okay with
it's
me.
Fine by me, too. Okay. And Love Music.
One of my favorite shows of the year. I love
was it really? I was bored. I couldn't.
Really?
Oh,
well,
yeah.
I fell, if I can use that word, K-V-E-L.
Yes, you may.
Over
yes,
Kurt Weill's...
Jews and
fell over Weill. that score, that music, and the way it was sung.
And the way... Yeah.
And the orchestrations. Heavenly orchestrations. I didn't have to hold my ears. We weren't blasted out of our seats. The, you know, this is one of my biggest
That's
gripes.
That's my wonderful Biltmore Theater. I just like that theater.
Great theater, yeah.
Let's, oh my gosh, so many thank yous to do to WGBB Station Manager Jeff Lowe and to Program Director Tom Ross for all their support and their ideas. I want to thank David Hinckley of the Daily News for giving us a plug. Thank you to Bill T. Jones, wishing him best of luck for Spring Awakening. He's nominated, as is Rebecca Luker. She's nominated for Feature Actress for Mary Poppins, and we thank them for being with us on the Tony special. Iris Dorbian, with so many critics that we had with us on the program. She's the editor of Stage Directions. Rosalind Friedman, Connecticut critic, thanks so much to her. Thank you to Michael Riedel of the New York Post and Charles Gross of the TV show Two on the Isle. Thank you to Jeannie Lieberman of TheaterScene.net and Glenn Loney of NewYorkTheaterWire.com. BroadwayStars.com author Ellis Nasur was also with us, and thanks to Michael Portantier, who's the senior editor of TheaterMania.com. Richmond Shepherd, who is my co-publisher on Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine, thanks so much, and he's also the owner of the Richmond Shepherd Theater. And a couple of thank yous to some press agents for all their help. Elon at the Jeffrey Richards Press Agency and Christine at Bono Brian Brown. Thank you also to Erica Ryan of the League of American Theaters and Producers, who wants me to remind you all that Stars in the Alley is happening this Wednesday afternoon, and Danny and Sandy from the New Grease will be there. And finally, guys, let me get you on the mic again. Thank you so much to Jeff Goodman of Two on the Isle and Simon Saltzman, president of the Outer Critics Circle. Thank you so much for being here. Oh, and thanks also to my lovely wife, Joyce, and best wishes to Lucy Ann, Simon's wife.
Forget about that. We're just bored.
We will. Thank you guys for sitting here for the full 3 hours, for your little bit of mic time.
It's been swell.
Are you looking forward to? Are you going to be watching the Tonys? Are you going to root and have a little party? Or are you just going to? What are you going to do next Sunday?
Saul and I getting together for a big party.
There you go. You're just sitting around and not get on microphones. Anyway, if you want copies of this program on CD, you can contact me at davesgoneby@aol.com. CDs will be made available in a week or two from now, and. That's about it. Reminder that the Tony Awards are next Sunday, followed by Dave's Gone by Sunday at 11, only on this station, WGBB AM 1240. We are going out with Spring Awakening. Here we go.
And all shall fade, the flowers of spring. Yeah.